person has power, but we've got to use our power in a collective, non-violent way.
From the Civil War to civil rights, from immigration battles to identity politics.
People here feel that they're invisible, frankly, and I think that's one of the problems.
An American Journey continues on Monday morning at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Saturday, the 24th of January. This is Alan Smith. Good morning. The government has delayed a parliamentary debate on its deal to hand back the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. The legislation was due to be discussed by the House of Lords on Monday, but the Conservatives have moved to stall it. Last week, President Trump criticised the deal. Our political correspondent Leila Nathu reports.
Under the terms of the government's proposed Chagos deal with Mauritius, the UK will lease back Diego Garcia, the largest of the islands, and home to a shared UK-US military base. The Conservatives claim passing the bill ratifying the deal would put the UK in contravention of a 1966 treaty agreed with the US over the islands. Last night, the Tories put down a motion to try to stall the bill's progress through Parliament until agreement is reached with the US over the treaty. Government sources say they're considering their response and the legislation will return at a later date.
Russia has launched more air raids on Ukraine overnight after the first direct talks involving the two sides and the US on President Trump's plan to end the war. The Ukrainian authorities said the strikes killed one person and wounded at least 15 others in Kyiv and the northeastern city of Kharkiv. The peace talks in Abu Dhabi are due to continue today. The Ukrainian political analyst Peter Zalmayev says people in the country have mixed feelings on the talks.
They're not getting their hopes up. What gets their hopes up is that, you know, Zelensky and Trump agreed on a continued shipments of American Patriot missiles to help Ukraine in this very dark and cold season. We'll take all the help we can get.
The government says ministers will be given new powers to intervene in failing police forces in England and Wales as part of measures to be unveiled next week. Under the plans, all forces will be made to answer to the Home Secretary. Our senior UK correspondent Seema Kotecha reports.
Police forces are currently not directly accountable to politicians. Ministers can't sack failing police leaders or instruct forces to improve. As part of the government's white paper on policing to be unveiled on Monday, ministers will be given new powers to send in specialist teams to turn around problematic forces. There'll be new laws enabling the government to force the retirement, resignation or suspension of chief constables. The Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood says this will drive up standards, but some senior officers have told the BBC putting control into the hands of politicians undermines their leadership.
The proposals will also introduce a licence to practice for police officers in England and Wales, modelled on the system used for lawyers and doctors. Ministers say officers will have to renew their licences throughout their careers, and those who fail to reach the required standard will be dismissed. The Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has until 5 o'clock this afternoon to decide whether to run in the Gorton and Denton by-election. Winning the Manchester seat would allow Mr Burnham to return to Westminster and potentially mount a leadership challenge to Keir Starmer. But as an elected mayor, he would need permission from Labour's ruling National Executive Committee to contest the by-election. Gemma Bolton, who represents constituency members on the NEC, told Newsnight that it would be outrageous if Mr Burnham was blocked.
I think it's right for the members of the constituency to get to decide who represents them. And if they want that to be Andy Burnham, then they should be able to vote for him. And the whole conversation currently needs to be about who is the strongest candidate to win in Gorton and Denton. And that's clearly going to be the popular Labour mayor of Manchester.
Part of the main railway line through Devon has been closed until this afternoon because of a rare black alert issued for Storm Ingrid. 12-foot-high waves are expected at Dawlish, where a storm destroyed sections of the track 12 years ago. Great Western Railway said there was a significant risk that the sea wall would be breached. That's the BBC News. We'll take a look at the papers in a minute, but first with the weather, here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Hello, good morning again. It's a frost-free start to the day, as we've just been hearing. Storm Ingrid continues to swirl away towards the far southwest of the UK. It's moved a little further northwards, but it's kind of stalled, really, bringing bands of showers across Wales and southwest England. Some of those showers heavy at times, although the far north of Wales should be drier. Very windy here too towards the southwest, 40 to 50 mile an hour winds. locally 55 to 60 plus for South Wales and for the coast of southwest England towards the south. Plenty of flood warnings in place. Those rain totals really mounting up. Northern Ireland, early rain and some showers should ease. It will be drier later with some brighter breaks, particularly towards the north. For Scotland, it's drier in the west with some brightness. Cloudy across the far north, more heavy rain, snow over the mountains towards the east, and brisk easterly winds are blowing here too. For the Midlands and central southern England, it's quite cloudy for many. There'll be some rain by the evening, but for the rest of England, it's largely dry. Brighter breaks, some cloud at times. It's a bit breezier. Top temperatures are 5 to 9 degrees.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Now for a look at the morning papers, and the Daily Telegraph leads on the delayed House of Lords debate on the Chagos Islands. The paper notes the Conservatives warning that the deal would violate a 60-year-old treaty with the US, and that both countries have been in talks since late last year about updating the agreement. The Daily Mail also leads on the story. It says the decision raises hope of the government's 15th U-turn. The reaction to President Trump claiming NATO troops stayed away from the front line in Afghanistan is the main story in the Daily Mirror. "Say sorry," reads its headline. The Daily Express says there are 457 tragic reasons why Mr. Trump is wrong in reference to the number of British military personnel killed in the conflict. The Times front page carries a warning from the government's work czar, Alan Milburn, who says a generation of young people with what he calls normal mental health conditions are being written off work for a life on benefits. Speaking to the paper, Mr. Milburn said the nearly 1 million young people out of work, education or training was a moral crisis. The Eye leads on the potential return of Labour's Andy Burnham to Parliament. The paper describes the Greater Manchester Mayor as the Prime Minister's rival because he's expected to launch a leadership challenge if he were to become an MP by winning the Gorton and Denton by-election. The report notes that Labour's far left fears the Health Secretary Wes Streeting would be most likely to challenge Sir Keir Starmer's leadership if Mr. Burnham doesn't return to Parliament. And confusion about the future of Greenland led to a surge in gold prices, according to the Financial Times. Its report says the metal is set for its best week in almost two decades after investors rushed to safe alternatives to the dollar because of concerns over what it calls erratic US policymaking. And that's our look at the morning papers. This is BBC Radio 4. The Today programme is at 7 o'clock, but now we're in Worcestershire for this week's Ramblings.
Well, if I'm honest, I always say the hills and mountains represent life. So we have these ups and we have these downs. You're not kind of guaranteed this view at the end of it, but it's that digging in. I prefer hard walks. I want it to be wet. I want it to be cold, because that's when you have to dig deep. And for my young people especially, it's a challenge that they normally would choose not to put themselves in for. So if they want that success, I'm not carrying them up. They've got to do it themselves. So long, hard walks, it's about grit.
I'm in Worcestershire today, walking with Steve Boycott, whose job now, who you have found your calling in life, because your job is to walk with young people, or to take use walking as a way of helping them through challenges that they might have.
Yeah, it's part of a bigger programme. So I'm a big believer in being outdoors, so a lot of the activities that I take on with the students are predominantly outdoors, and walking makes up a chunk of that.
And the hill that we are going to climb today is your local hill.
Yeah, I live on the base of it, on the north side, so I'm constantly up Breedon Hill, especially in more the summer months, I suppose, just because of access. Yeah, this is what I would call my back garden.
We've started then from the Queen Elizabeth Pub in Elmley Castle, which is on the Ordnance Survey map. It's OS Explorer map OL45, which is the Cotswolds north. And if you want to find it on what three words, it's importing tall thud. I do love the words that come
out. Kind of how I would describe yourself.
Tall, definitely.
Yeah, 6'5" is kind of tall, I suppose.
Yeah. Actually, on visual appearance, do people judge you? I've got a nephew who's very tall. Do people judge you at a distance before they meet you?
Yes, and I'm very aware of how I look. You know, I say 6'5", bearded, tattooed. Yeah, I do get that judgment straight away. However, I don't like people taller than me, so as soon as I think I see someone who's taller than me, I walk in the opposite direction. Not used to it.
Competitive height, hey?
Yeah, I'm just not used to it.
We're going past a cottage on the right, a thatched cottage with bright white walls, and the sun has broken through the milky sky. And it's brightening up into a really lovely winter's day. It wasn't promising first thing this morning, but that feeling of gaining height, which we are already, getting up into the sky, the light, being able to look down on the countryside, all those things I find hugely uplifting. And I would imagine that the youngsters you walk with, they might not know that that's going to be the benefit, but they feel it.
Yeah, what's quite sad is a lot of the young people I work with who are within a couple of miles of Breedon or the Malverns have never walked them. Although they have access, they don't access it. So when they get to the top and they see the beautiful landscape, it's, they can't hide their joy. That's what's nice.
What sort of age group are you working with?
As young as year 7, 8, and I go all the way up to 14, 15 years of age.
Yeah. And where do you find them the most receptive to thinking differently?
I would say they're more sponge-like, primary to secondary transition age. So 9, 10, 11, 12.
And how long have you been doing this?
So I left the army in 2013, and then I started working for a national charity in 2014, and I set up my own company back in 2016. So what's that?
So, well, it's, yeah, and it's long enough to see a pattern, because a parent can only see their own children, but teachers can see the children of lots of different people, and so can you.
Yeah, you get a better snapshot.
Yeah.
There's definitely a change, and I think COVID was, if we use that as the middle,
yeah.
Post-COVID, there's definitely been a change, more so with resilience, that social interaction, conflict resolution. Yes, they've got similar challenges, but they just don't seem to have the skills to deal with those challenges, which is why I hope I come in.
Steve, does your programme have a name?
Yes, yeah, so it's the BU programme, so BEYOU, and it's all about believing in themselves, it's about being themselves, not wear that mask, what they wear to fit in with everyone around them. So we're trying to get them to stand out, and we're all very different, and I want to highlight that as we're going up the incline, and yeah. I'm trying to talk and breathe.
The birds are very vocal today. And as we walk up this road, it's country road, not a car to be seen or heard. A couple of stables on the left, a low buttery-coloured Cotswold stone wall on our left, and a high hedge on the right. And again, thatched cottages with moss growing on the thatch. Beautiful brick chimneys, very picturesque. And just the birds are what's really capturing me today. So, Steve, talk me through the route that we're taking today.
Well, this goes up. So the incline now will take us up through Elmley Castle, up to the top of Breedon Hill. We'll then walk along the ridge to the Folly. We'll have beautiful views across Worcestershire and south to Gloucestershire. It's going to be a combination of small paths, open woodland, open fields. First quarter of the walk is all uphill, and it should level out for the middle section. As I say, we've got some of the wet stuff coming in, yeah. But we might escape it. It's one thing I say to all my students is we are going out regardless of the weather.
Yeah, that's what we do as well, but we did get slightly caught out by the snow, so we were meant to go to Aberdeenshire and we couldn't.
Snow's a different thing, I think. I'm a mountain leader, but I can only take people up to the snow line. So if we do have snow, it does cancel my day out with the students.
Come into a very narrow, muddy lane. And suddenly the vegetation has gone a bit rainforest. We've got ferns all around us. Very squidgy underfoot. Oh, look, there are people on the horizon walking across the top of Breedon Hill. You're listening to Ramblings on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds. I'm with Steve Boycott today, who has set up a programme to help youngsters, I guess, find the skills of resilience, yes, and a love of the outdoors.
Yeah, it's those soft skills that you can be transferred no matter what career path you take, no matter what education path you take. So everything from teamwork and communication through to that resilience. And I always say you need to be resilient for three things. That's challenge, change and failure. So a lot of part of the course is pushing my students to fail. I want them to experience that. The only way to develop resilience is exposure to the things you want to be resilient to.
Last bit of the climb ahead of us, I think. Is it?
Yeah, we're not too far off now.
Where did you learn those skills of resilience?
I would say I always taught to my scout leaders. I was very lost as a young boy, struggled with my own self-esteem, and they were brilliant. They got us outside, they got us up mountains, we were kayaking and camping, and that was the start of my journey, really, so I owe a lot to them.
And what did the army teach you, and how do you translate it to what you do now?
The army taught me everything's going to be hard. It doesn't get easier, you just simply get better at doing it. And I think they taught us how to get stuck in, how to have grit, that you were going to get it wrong, you were going to fail.
But presumably they didn't want you to fail. They're not embracing it.
No,
they
do.
Do they?
I think that's the thing. A lot of people think that you've got to be the fastest, you've got to be the best, you've got to always be perfect. The army don't want that. The army wants someone who's going to get it wrong and can evaluate and bounce back. There's a saying, I can never remember who said it, but the problem is not the problem. The problem is the attitude towards the problem. And I think one of the things I want to do on the programme is help young people gain that right attitude so they don't give up, that they do push on even when they get it wrong or even when it doesn't go their way.
And by turning your focus outwards to helping others, is it also helping you?
Oh, massively. I think because I did struggle as a kid, and when I left the army, I left that family, and I needed to replace that. Helping young people kind of give me that purpose. I love going to school. I love meeting new people and seeing how we can work together.
Where was your childhood? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Wolverhampton. I went to school in Dudley, stayed there until sixth form, and then I got the travel bug and left, and then I've kind of lived all over the world.
And then you settled here. How long have you been here? Which isn't far, frankly. It's not far from where you grew up, but it is different.
Yeah, so one day I was driving through Pershore. I was looking at the time to see if I could move into the area. Found a little cottage on a farm. 11 years I've been here now, and they're going to have to drag me out kicking and screaming, I think.
In terms of running the farm, who does that?
It's a kind of a joint effort. It's not a commercial farm. It's kind of close to a small holding in the sense that everything we do on there is for our own consumption. But we all chip in. So we all help raise the sheep. We all grow all our own fruit and veg. We all help with the coppicing of wood for winter. It's a community. And I think that's one of the things a lot of my students are also missing, that sense of belonging to a community. We are seeing a rise in gangs, for example, because we just have lost that sense of community.
And I guess the gangs, in a warped way, are creating that team, albeit for nefarious ends.
Oh, I think gangs are exactly replacing what is missing, especially with young boys. They don't know where they fit in. They don't know who's there for them. And therefore, when someone comes knocking and says, come and join us, come and be with us, that sense of family, if you haven't had it, even the sense of achievement.
Yeah. Somebody wants you.
Yes,
want
someone
you.
Wants us. We all want to be loved. And I think if you've been unfortunate and never had that throughout your childhood, you'll go looking for what you need.
I'm intrigued by this space on the left, the other side of a low moss-covered wall. Almost feels like a... I mean, it's a little wood, but it feels like a sacred place.
I think Breedon has that feel across all of it. There's definitely a spirit with Breedon. So when you come up here, especially when you're by yourself, you just sit here, you can almost feel the hill. I'm not very spiritual, but there is a personality to it. And you've actually found one of my hidey places. I come up and just sit against the wall, and in the summer especially, and just sit and listen and watch. And it's a beautiful view across the valley.
Well, it gives you protection from the wind on a day like this, because when we were on the ridge, you could really feel the buffeting of a chilly wind. But here you feel, suddenly it's quiet, it's protected. I imagine in the summer it's cooler, much cooler than being out in the open. And through the gap in these trees, you can see down to, that's the Vale of Evesham, is it?
So that's the Vale of Evesham, that's the north side of the hill. And if we go through this gate just here, it'll completely open up the view for us. So on a clear day, you would have the Malverns over there to the west. Just before there, in the kind of foreground, you might just see a satellite. That's the National Trust at Croom. So that's the old World War II satellite station there, I believe now used for the police. And then into our immediate front, there's Pershaw. And just in front, right in front of us, at the base of the hill, that's Great Comberton.
Is that the River Avon then coming round there?
So we're quite lucky here. So we have the River Avon here, and then just a little bit further over, you've got the River Severn.
Is this the way you start your day? And certainly when the days are longer, do you come up here nearly every day?
Yes. So if we over this wall right now is a sheer climb really up the hill, and this is my way up. So during the summer holidays, because I only work term time, I climb this every day of the summer holidays. So I'm up at 5 o'clock, straight into my walking boots, up the hill, get to the top, turn around, back down. And it's that sense of, again, I've started the day with an accomplishment. I think everyone should start the day with doing some physical exercise. And a lot of young people especially are just not being that physical. And they're getting to school and they're tired. They haven't had breakfast. They've not exercised. Some of them may have not exercised since the previous PE lesson. And I think doing this and introducing the young people to this is, I think, vital for not only them now, but for their future self. I'm a big believer you've got to be kind to your future self. You might not enjoy it while you're doing it, but your future self will be thankful.
That feels good. You know, just walking right into a strong wind, everything starts tingling.
Yeah.
I feel a bit more alive. Is that Braden Folly?
Yeah.
It's just a squat tower. I mean, I can't pretend that it's...
It's beautiful.
Okay, fine. But Broadway Tower, I can understand why that's getting all the tourist interest. This one's sort of short and squat and solid.
And then we've got the Elephant Rock here.
Oh, that really does look like an elephant, like a baby elephant. And it's covered in... It looks like it's sort of covered in mollusks, almost. Oh, that really does. You can see its ear and its eye and its trunk, and then through its body. I think it's kneeling down in front, isn't it? The sun is just...
It wants to break through.
It wants to. It's trying to, but it's just hitting a couple of the paler fields.
It's a beautiful county. I get the privilege. I work with over 50 schools, so I get to tour the county, and not a day goes by where I'm not grateful for my drive to work, because I get nothing but greenery and handmade walls and birds of prey and deer and muntjac, which beats driving down the motorway or going down the urban roads and seeing nothing but traffic lights.
But actually interesting, talking of those urban, I mean the big roads, the big motorways, you worked on the M6, didn't you, when the toll road was built?
I did, yeah. So when I left school, I wanted to save as much money as I could to travel. So I worked on there for just under 3 years. I was a timekeeper.
So what does that mean?
Looking after the men, making sure they're paid, it was an admin role, but involved being outside with them, getting to know them. And at 18, I was very shy, very timid, and being thrown in the deep end with these really experienced men helped me develop those core skills. And then when the M6 toll was opened and come to an end, I found myself at a bit of a decision to make. And I made the decision to sell all my belongings, bought a one-way ticket to Southeast Asia, to Thailand, and I set off. And I think a lot of friends and family didn't think I'd do it because it wasn't who I was. I didn't have the skills to do that. And I didn't think I was going to do it at one point. It was a big step. So I went to Thailand and Cambodia. I ended up opening a guest house with some friends in Cambodia and stayed there for a little while. Toured Vietnam, Laos. I studied in Thailand, so I went to college up in Chiang Mai, become an enhanced or an advanced Thai masseur qualification. And then my journey took me to Australia, ended up working as what was called a carny, so working on the shows, the mobile fairgrounds, touring Western Australia. So I did that for a little while, made my way over to Melbourne, stayed with some friends there, and then made it to North America, travelled from California up into Vancouver, up British Columbia, into Alaska, and then I came over into the Yukon. And at all times, no matter where I was, I always did some walking. I always hiked. I went up the local and Blue Mountains in Australia, the jungle treks in Cambodia and in Thailand. But eventually I came home, and then one day I was walking past the Army Careers Office, and I joined the Army.
So what age were you then when you...
So I joined the Army when I was 24. So
you'd done all of that before you were 24?
Yeah.
That's extraordinary.
So from 18 to 24 was busy.
Yeah, Steve, it was busy.
Yeah. And then, so I was in the Army from 2007 to 2013. Uh-huh. And I became an ammunition technician. I served in Afghan in 2010, attached to the One Lanx Battle Group. So I was attached to the infantry. And then on return, I qualified as a bomb disposal number 2 operator and joined 11 EOD Upper Cataract Troop.
We've left Parsons Folly behind us and walking along the top of the ramparts now that would have formed the edge of an Iron Age fort. And the grass is all bending in towards us from the right because that's the direction the wind is coming from. And it's fresh, it's freshened up. Look at those beams coming through. Just, you know, when you get that little gap in the cloud, suddenly shafts of sunlight. Very pale, fairly weak, but look at that effect over on the right. Do you see there, Steve? Look.
Yep.
Oh, there, yeah, where it's just lighting up the edge of that, the side of that hill.
And we've got a pheasant just sat on the wall here.
Oh, yeah.
Just along the wall, making some noise.
I can see its white collar.
And you do have these little groups of trees that, if I was to kind of be sat with my students now, I'd say that's a team of trees. They're there, they're supporting each other, they're protecting each other from the weather. Then you get these little trees just by themselves and how much of a different life they're having. They're being hit all the time, they're alone. And yeah, that is what happens. We are alone sometimes. We might not have the support of our friends or our family around us, but doesn't mean we still can't be successful. It doesn't mean that we can't be resilient. But it does help having the right people around you.
It's that very claggy mud, isn't it? It's real skiddy. You sort of go for almost it's easier to slide. I'm pretending I'm cross-country skiing with these poles.
Oh, the cleaning boots.
Yeah, got a nice bit of water. Look, I found out another good use for my poles. I can take mud off with them. Sort of. Good. What's your ambition with this project? What would you want it to be if you could in 10 years' time?
Oh, in 10 years' time, I'd like to maybe be teaching new instructors on how to go out and help even more young people in their own way. For young people, I'd like for it to be a sustainable project. Every school has maybe a hub or a programme where it's dedicated to helping raise self-esteem and resilience. So I think my ambition would be to really push this need to raise self-esteem, get people believing in themselves, adults and children. Yes, that's kind of where I'd like to carry on pushing it.
You'll still be heading up that hill when you're long retired, I think.
Well, I hope so. My neighbour's 81. No one's told him that. You know, he's out logging, they go skiing, they go hiking, he's active, and that's an inspiration to me. Where other people I know in their 40s, 50s and 60s have kind of given up and that's it. They just sit around and do very little.
Well, good luck with it all. No one can accuse you of not packing it all in. I'm loving that. Living life, every second of it.
I think one of the things that I said to my mum and dad is if they were stood at the altar giving a eulogy, they can't say that I still had lots of things I've never got around to doing. I wanted to try and do as much of it as I can. Say yes and have a go, and if you don't like it, well, don't do it again.
Ramblings with Claire Balding is produced by Karen Greger. It's a BBC Studios audio production for Radio 4. Farming Today This Week is next.
This is our BBC. It can take us anywhere.
I hear we're going down the beach.
Raise questions.
So let's try and join all the dots.
Bring us down to Earth.
Floating in a space suit.
We can share it with others.
Children need are going to help so many people with that money.
Or keep it to ourselves.
Mr. Shelby will always be alone.
Join millions of people.
Live at the Royal Albert Hall, where we are.
Building our future.
The BBC has put £5 billion into the economy.
There's a BBC for each of us, funded by all of us.
Much to discover.
This is our BBC.
Later on this morning, it's Saturday Live, and Adrian Charles' guests this week include the Strictly star Anton Dubek, the double winter Olympic champion Lizzie Arnold, and the scent expert Michael O'Shaughnessy. Saturday Live is at 9. But now on Radio 4, it's time for Farming Today This Week with Charlotte Smith.
Hello. This week, the price of milk. Are UK dairy farmers facing the sharpest milk price crash in history?
All of this macro global trade and toing and froing has had an impact on individual farmers across the EU and the UK.
And keeping farm animals fed on the Western Isles.
The last load I came in with was about 560 wee bales and about 54 round bales. So some people want wee bales and some people want round bales. So you have to try and mix it all together. It's a bit of a jigsaw.
Bales by land and sea later in the programme. Let's start with the profit farming businesses make or don't make. This week, MPs on the Environment Select Committee questioned Baroness Batters, the former NFU president who wrote the government-commissioned review on farm profitability. It was published just before Christmas and, as you'd expect, Baroness Batters told the MPs all 57 recommendations should be implemented. The committee chairman, Alistair Carmichael, also asked her about the proposed farming roadmap, the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs blueprint for the future of the industry.
DEFRA needs to be talking to many more farmers, and that is in the recommendation in the agri-growth hubs and also the catchment approach. There is not a relationship with the farmers on the ground at the moment, which is why so many do not understand what the plan is.
And Baroness Batters told the committee DEFRA's civil servants need to get their wellies on and get them muddy to understand farming from the inside.
I have to say, to start off with, I said they should be sleeping in the lambing sheds. And then I decided that was better to change that and say they should be helping in the daytime in the lambing sheds. But what I was trying to establish was you've got to get out of Whitehall. You've got to get out to understand. Equally, farmers have got to come in. So you've got to have change on both sides of understanding and working and developing together.
Baroness Batters emphasised that food production should be profitable and that each farming sector should have its own plan. This, she said, would allow output to be monitored and increase UK-grown food supply. There were also detailed questions from the MPs about the future of England's Sustainable Farming Incentive, or SFI. This, as you may remember, is one of the Environmental Land Management Schemes, or ELMs, which replaced EU payments. It pays farmers for the environmental work they do. Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland have their own different schemes. Well, the Sustainable Farming Incentive was suddenly shut last March as the money ran out, and it won't reopen until June, with applications initially restricted to small farms. Baroness Batters said the SFI structure was a mistake.
I think it was set up in totally the wrong way. If you have a scheme that is open-ended and demand-led, you have no idea what the demand will be, so you have no idea of the value that will be demanded. So you can understand why the Treasury would be enormously frustrated by a scheme like that. And then to come into government without the knowledge of this scheme could run out of money. And, of course, in the desire in the last parliament to get the money out the door, the payment rates were raised. So a lot of people then did come forwards. But because, again, it was demand-led and you didn't know what the demand would be, the money disappeared very quickly. So in many ways it was set up to fail. But it is, I think, the SFI can be a really good scheme, and it is the scheme. So we've got to now make it work.
Baroness Minette Batters at the Environment, Food and Rural Affairs Select Committee. Staying with profitability, this week DEFRA published its most recent set of farm business survey figures for the year from March 2024 to February 2025. They show that average incomes across all farm types rose by 49%. James Webster Rusk from the consultants Andersons told Kaz Graham that the stats also paint a picture of just how important non-farming enterprises and those government schemes which pay farmers for environmental work have become.
On the whole, on the face of things, they do show an increase in the profitability of English farming from the year 2023-24 to the year ending February 2025. There are some challenges within that, though. One thing we do see is the real drive of increase in agri-environment scheme income and also in diversification income, not necessarily in the income from agriculture, the business of farming itself. And we see also a significant variation between some of the sectors as well. So from year to year, we see a good increase in the performance of dairy businesses. And we also see some increases coming through for poultry. But other sectors have fared less well, notably the cereals and the general cropping sector.
The price that farmers are now being paid by dairy processors is in a major slump. So although they had a really good year in this particular one that these figures represent, it doesn't really mean that that's going to continue, does it?
No, absolutely. The dairy sector and the cereal sector look set for further challenges. The cereal sector in particular had a poor year, challenging yields. It was a particularly wet establishment period. And then also we've seen cereal prices fall. That's 2 years of losses from agriculture, the business of farming, business of producing crops. And if it wasn't for agri-environment schemes and diversification, those businesses would be making a loss.
James Webster Rusk from Andersons. Well, as Kaz mentioned, the relative highs of the last financial year may well feel like ancient history to dairy farmers right at the moment. The price they're paid for milk has been tumbling since the autumn, with further cuts announced this month. The reason? A perfect storm of geopolitical events coinciding with a boom in production. Dairy analyst Chris Walkland talked Kaz through the situation.
There was obviously a huge trade scrap between Trump and China earlier in the year. And one of the net effects of that was a ban, I think it was a total ban on soya exports to China from the US. There was a lot of soya kicking around on the US market, and that made US feed prices a lot cheaper. So dairy farmers capitalized on the cheap feed, fed their cows a lot more concentrate, and that resulted in additional milk yields in America. But it's not just the China trade deals that had an impact. Trump was also playing hardball on trade with us and the EU. a lot of butter was imported into the EU at the same time as milk production really started to ramp up over here.
Because dairy farmers in the UK had a really strong year last year, didn't they?
Yes, and they did in the EU. So not only was there strong production, milk production in the EU and the UK, the Americans started to export a lot more butter over here. They've never done it before. And the traders in Europe said, oh, we'll have some of that cheaper American stuff. All of this macro global trade and toing and froing has had an impact on individual farmers across the EU and the UK.
Here in the UK, dairy farmers had, as I mentioned earlier, this record year of milk production. What was behind that last year?
If you actually take the milk volumes that they produced in 2025, multiply it by the milk price, it was record incomes. All of the milk production ducks lined up in a perfect row. The weather was okay for most. Some were affected by drought. Milk prices were really good. Feed prices were cheap. There were no animal disease problems in the EU or in America. And all of the ducks lined up for brilliant milk production, and the farmers capitalized on that. And now they are all over the world effectively being a victim of their own success.
I mean, the difficult thing for a lot of UK dairy farmers, I suppose, is that the milk prices that they receive are now going down, but they're going to want to keep driving production up, aren't they? Because the prices are lower, but they still need to pay the bills, don't they?
That is the temptation a lot of them will have. When the milk price drops, they produce more to try and maintain their income. And we're in the scenario where what is good for the industry as a whole, i.e. for everybody to reduce production, is not necessarily in the interests of an individual farming business.
So what would you think could pull dairy markets out of this nosedive that they're in at the moment?
Well, there's only two things that will do that. One is supply, one is demand. Those are the two drivers for markets. Demand isn't going to change much at all, I don't think. So it has to be a supply driven correction. What matters is what milk production is like in the US, in Germany and France. Germany and France are the big powerhouses of EU milk production. So what happens there is critical. Reducing production here will help. But if we reduce production and Europe doesn't, it won't make that much difference.
You've said that UK dairy farmers are facing the worst milk crash in history. I mean, that's a pretty strong statement. Is the situation really that bad?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at the numbers and I've compared previous years where the milk prices have crashed, and prices have come down faster this time than at any other time in history. And despite the fact that farmers have had a brilliant 2025, all of that good is going to be undone very quickly in 2026, because milk prices for most farmers are really terrible.
Dairy analyst Chris Walkland talking to Kaz there. As he mentioned, drought was a concern for dairy farmers in some areas last year, something which is still having an effect on the economics of their businesses. Feeding cows is a significant chunk of the cost of producing milk. And this week on Farming Today, we've been focusing on feeding animals through the winter. Peter Brewer has a herd of 70 cows on his mixed farm near Ross-on-Wye in Herefordshire. He told our reporter Bob Huckenhull about the extra cost of finding enough forage.
Normally, sort of first cut grass silage, we'd look to make sort of 350, 400 tons to go into the silage pit. Then any surplus after that on subsequent cuts would go into round bales or hay, and we'd sort of normally make 700 to 800 of those bales. This year we only made 300, 350, I think. So we don't have that surplus to feed later on. So we didn't have any spring growth in the grass. We didn't have any grass through the summer, and it really impacted on the other crops, particularly our forage maize crop. That ended up being half the yield that we would normally expect. So we've ended up then buying in a lot of extra forage.
Presumably it's cost you quite a lot.
buying in that maize has cost us about £20,000. And then the actual growing of the crop costs the same, but because the yield is half, it costs twice as much for what we've got in the pit. If spring's sort of 2 weeks late, then we're going to be looking at walls and floors and not having anything to feed the cows.
You'll have to fork some money out and buy some, presumably, will you?
Unfortunately, I don't think we're in the financial position now to buy any more in. We're in a fortunate position where we have grazing for the cows, so the only thing we will be able to do is turn them out onto less than ideal grass in bad conditions. If that's what it comes to, then that's what we'll have to resort to doing.
Dairy farmer Peter Brewer. Well, as we heard there, growing crops successfully for winter feed can make a big difference to the bottom line. The weather in West Wales was kinder for growing maize alongside a new crop, sunflowers, on Clear Griffiths' dairy farm. As Marie-Claire Carey-Jones reports, it's an experiment aimed at reducing the amount of protein feed he needs to buy in.
We are milking 500 pedigree Holsteins here.
So you've got some of your calves in front of you here?
Yeah, these are weaned calves. They start off in individual hutches and then they move into groups and then move around the farm as we go.
Well, we've walked over now to what you call your maize bunker.
Yeah, so we grow around 200 acres of maize here, along with 500 acres of grass in the clump next door. And we are 2 years deep now into a maize and sunflower project. 20 acres of companion cropped maize with sunflowers. So, you know, it's 10% of what we're doing. We've had some funding through Farming Connect, and it's something I quite enjoy. I quite enjoy an R&D project.
And why did you want to start growing the sunflowers?
Just to raise the protein in the mix. So far, we've had a real mixture of results. The first year, we found it difficult to get a consistent crop because the maize drilling, we mixed the seed and it wasn't running nicely through the drill. Whereas this year, it's been a lot better. The analysis has come back 32% starch with 10% protein, whereas your standard crop of maize is your sort of 8% protein. So I know it's only small gains, but over a large area, it'll make a big difference.
Why is it important to you to be able to grow your winter feed here on the farm?
With volatility in milk prices and things, we can't rely on the milk price to be able to buy in all of our feed. We're obviously buying in a lot of food to the business, but we aren't buying any forage in. And I guess by being more self-sufficient in protein, it means we've got to buy less protein, which is going to be obviously financially beneficial.
Well, I've just walked to another part of the farm now to talk to Simon Pitt, who is the Farming Connect Dairy Officer.
Clear is one of our participants in the Tryout Fund project. Anything that reduces cost on farm that's grown at home has got to be an option to consider.
And are more farms looking to do things like this to increase their winter feed?
Yes, without question. It reduces the reliance on purchased in feeds at a lower cost, and hopefully they can produce good yields as a result.
Now, we're doing this interview here in the shed with the noisy cars behind us because it is raining outside. What sort of a role does the Welsh climate play in the success or otherwise of projects like this?
Well, it can play quite a vast role because we had a terrifically wonderful summer this year, which it could have dented growth, but it was actually quite good for many, particularly the maize growers, whereas the previous year it was a much tougher year and crops were grown later and the rain impacted on the yield.
Marie-Claire Carey-Jones reporting from a wet Cardiganshire. For many years, organic pig and poultry feed blends were able to include up to 5% non-organic ingredients. But that changed on the 1st of January this year. Any birds over 30 weeks old and pigs over 35 kilos must now be fed with 100% organic diets. It brings UK producers in line with EU organic rules. Marie Lennon has been to Eastleach Farm in Gloucestershire to meet Helen Wade and her herd of pigs.
Hello, darling. Hello.
All right, you silly.
We grow 3 years of cereal and pulse crops, bicrops, so we grow wheat and beans together and pea and barley usually together, with some oats. And then we sow herbal lay, and then we silage that in the first year, and then in the second year, the pigs go onto it and just dig it up.
And have a lovely time doing
it.
This is a commercial organic
pig farm, and there aren't many of those. What are your feed costs like?
Oh, huge, huge, and that is why organic pork costs so much more. They are probably 2.5 times a commercial system.
Nicely walk across the yard, and we are now in your grain store.
Yeah, so in here we've got the wheat and bean mix, the main component of our pig feed. This tank here has got organic oilseed rape oil, and here is our potato protein. So we use a very small amount. We use 5% in our ration of potato protein. It's actually produced in France. Now, currently we're allowed to use this under the derogation of a 5% non-organic protein source. Basically, it replaces soya for us. We only need to use a small amount of this in our ration. So the change that's come in has meant, really, that we're going to have to use soya. It would be organic soya, which is available, but at the moment it's only available from China, from much further away. And we do have customers that are buying our pork because it's soya-free, which is a real step backwards.
Well, I've left behind those huddles of pigs scuttling about high up on a very green Cotswold hill to come a few miles down the road to a different farm, because that deregulation of the 5% non-organic allowance in feed also applies to poultry. John Newman is farm manager here at Abbey Home Farm near Cirencester. We can't go and see your chickens because of bird flu regulation, but tell me what I would see if I could go and see your chickens.
OK, so we have about 250 to 300 layers, depends on time of year. They're all in one house producing eggs that we sell through our farm shop. And then we also have meat birds that all get processed and go through the farm shop.
Having the 5% allowance of non-organic matter within that organic feed mix, what do you get from that?
So generally the 5% bit that's been in there in the past would be to do with the protected proteins and to do with the supply of amino acid in the ration. Very, very challenging feeding poultry particularly. They seem to be much more vulnerable about how the amino acid balances in their diet and how that affects either how fast they grow or how many eggs they produce or, you know, their overall health and welfare. And it was just about availability, really. It was difficult to get these ingredients organically, so therefore there was an allowance. But there was always a desire to move to that. It's been there for a long time that it would be going out. It's just, I guess, we've now reached the point where, you know, the line is drawn.
And luckily, your supplier has made up that 5% and now it's completely organic, so you haven't got to do any more legwork. It's the work has been done for you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we buy from a supplier who has taken that initiative. And I guess most consumers would have been thinking it was 100% organic feed anyway. So it just feels like we're just kind of catching up a little bit in some respects.
Marie Lennon reporting there. Getting hold of supplies is a whole lot more complicated if you're farming on an island. Crofters on the Western Isles rely on hay and straw brought in by lorry and ferry from mainland Scotland. Nancy Nicholson hopped into the cab of a haulier whose family has been supplying forage to the Western Isles and Skye for generations as he embarked on the journey to Lewis.
Morning. Climbing up into the cab of Ryan Ironside's huge hay and straw lorry on a freezing cold morning. It's still dark out there, snow on the ground, and so the job today and every day for you is dropping off bales of hay and straw to crofters all over the island.
Multi-drop.
So multi-drops. Yeah. And you've come from where?
Gamery, down beside Banff, northeast of Scotland.
So you're taking straw and hay from arable farmers on the east and dropping it off at the west?
So mostly Aberdeenshire, the hay and straw comes from. It's never just a straightforward load of round bales or square bales. It's usually like a mixture. Like the last load I came in with was about 560 wee bales and about 54 round bales. So some people want wee bales and some people want round bales. So you have to try and mix it all together. It's a bit like jigsaw.
Let's go, you're right.
£79.50.
So that's for wee bales.
That's for the wee bales. That's for the sheep. There's three rams up there. I gave them the last of last year's yesterday.
Would you be able to do what you do here without a service like this, bringing in
I don't
hay
think
and
so.
Straw?
No. I can't take much in that at
in
all.
Your car? No.
No. So this is great. Delivered it to the door with a smile on his face.
always.
It's not cheap, though, to have to get fodder brought in here.
It's not cheap, but it's not bad. I'd still keep buying them.
You'll still keep buying. Have you worked with Ryan's father and his grandfather as well?
His grandfather, yes, the old fellow. Well, I think he's a lot younger than I am. But I don't know.
Back into the lorry. It's getting a wee bit lighter now. This is a big lorry. You've got fuel costs, you've got ferry costs. How much does a ferry cost for a lorry like this?
It's over the £600 mark. They do help a wee bit because we get a hay rate, so as long as we're coming in with hay and straw, as long as we go back out completely empty, we go out for the price of the pier dues. A round bale of hay is £64 delivered, and a round bale of straw is £48 delivered. And the wee bales are £7.95 for a bale of hay and £6.95 for a bale of straw. We go to Skye as well, and I mean, a round bale in Skye is £49.50. So that just shows like the difference with the ferry costs involved.
Is this the last drop?
This is the last stop in this road anyway.
Good morning, Nightingale. It's not a great day.
It's not a great day.
How many bales are you getting today?
100.
You wish.
So, and there's your bill.
I suppose I'd better pay him.
Do you depend on him?
Totally, 100%. It's good quality, it's good service and reliable.
And you're delivered to your door?
Or
in about four or five places for you?
Exactly where you want it.
You can't really make fodder here.
Oh, not now. We used to. Different climate altogether now. It's too wet.
That's 10 drops with just a lorry by itself around the island. That's quite an easy load, quite a good load for a change. I've seen me having anything from 18 to 28 drops.
So it's back on the ferry tonight. You'll get a rest on the ferry and then all the way home and out again tomorrow up to Skye.
Yeah. It is a lot more challenging when it's snowing and the roads aren't so great. It takes a wee bit longer to do it and that. And there's a lot of places you sometimes can't get to when it's bad weather, but you just got to do your best. When you know you're appreciated, you didn't mind going an extra mile. It helps.
Bye, thank you.
Nancy Nicholson with Ryan Ironside there. And that's it from us. I'm back tomorrow lunchtime with a special programme about the increasing amount of illegal meat being smuggled into the country and the risk that poses both to our health and to farms. That's The Price of Meat here on BBC Radio 4 tomorrow at 1:30. I'm Charlotte Smith. The producer today was Sarah Swadling. Farming Today This Week is a BBC Audio Bristol production.
And now with an update on the weather, here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Thank you. Well, the worst of the weather again is towards the far southwest, the far northeast of the UK. There are various flood warnings in force. You can take a look at the BBC Weather website for all of the details on those. So Storm Ingrid continues to swirl away towards the far southwest of England, also affecting many parts of South Wales as well. It's moved a little further north, but it's largely stalled, and that's part of the problem. So there'll be bands of showers on and off throughout the day across Wales, southwest England. Some of those showers likely to be heavy at times. The far north of Wales should be a little drier, but it's very windy. Gusts of wind towards the far south coast of around 55 to 65 miles an hour. Watch out at high tide, there could be some coastal overtopping, and the rainfall totals really starting to mount up here. For Northern Ireland, early rain and showers are clearing. It'll be drier later. Could be some brightness as well towards the north. Across Scotland, it's drier in the west. Some brightness, cloudier though for the far north, Caithness, Sutherland and the Northern Isles. Heavy rain though again towards the east. Another Met Office a yellow weather warning here. Some flood warnings too. Snow over the hills, all been driven in by brisk easterly winds. For much of England away from the far southwest, then it's largely dry today. Plenty of cloud across the Midlands, central southern England, some rain by the evening, but the best of the brightness will be across parts of East Anglia, also for northwest England and, well, northern England in general, and across the far south and the east as well. It's a breezier day across the board, 5 to 9 degrees Celsius with a bit of added wind chill. Tonight, the low pressure in the southwest pushes the rain a little further northwards and eastwards. Across the UK, it'll be quite showery in nature. The winds will ease a little in the south. Lows of 4 to 7 degrees. So, again, it is a frost-free start to the day. Tomorrow, the winds will gradually lighten throughout the day. It's going to be quite cloudy and rather damp for many of us with, again, some showery outbreaks of rain.
Thanks, Elizabeth. The Today programme is next. But first, how have leading cultural figures found inspiration for their work? Radio 4 is on the case.
The buzz. When I go for a run and I have an idea...
I'm John Wilson, and on This Cultural Life, I meet some of the world's leading artistic figures to explore the people, the places, and the cultural works that have inspired them. So far in this series, we've heard from comedian and actor Ricky Gervais, photographer Annie Leibovitz, and in the next episode, discussing his life on stage and screen, actor Jonathan Pryce.
How I got into performing and acting was there were more people saying they liked my acting than had ever said they liked my painting.
Listen to This Cultural Life, Thursday mornings at 11 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning. It's 7 o'clock on Saturday, the 24th of January. Let's start the weekend together, shall we? This is Today with Anna Foster in Salford and Emma Barnett in London.
Good morning. The headlines today. The government has been forced to delay legislation handing the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, accusing the Conservatives of reckless behaviour. Russia has attacked Ukrainian cities with missiles ahead of a second day of direct talks on President Trump's peace plan. And ministers will be given powers to intervene in failing police forces in England and Wales under a shake-up to be unveiled next week.
Also in today's programme, it's been another week of President Trump dominating the international stage with threats of tariffs and invasions. But how is that approach going down with his voters back home?
When they go to the grocery store, prices are higher. Utility bills for things like electricity are increasing. And some of the promises he's made, such as bringing down the cost of housing, those haven't come to pass either.
We'll get into that and a lot more. Plus, on this side of the pond, politicians are wrestling with the idea of banning social media for under 16s. But many teenagers have told us they will get around any future ban. Does it matter if you introduce a law that many won't obey? We'll think about that and some of the consequences and perhaps how behaviours do really change. And...
Oh, apple, apple tree.
Oh, apple, apple tree.
Sounds lovely. Why a group of gardeners in Leeds are trying to revive wassailing.
I'm Sarah Orchard with your Saturday Sport. We'll head to Melbourne in the next half an hour on a sweltering day at the Australian Open after play was suspended earlier and almost 100,000 fans were warned to take care in the heat.
But first, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The government has delayed a parliamentary debate on its controversial deal to hand back the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. The draft legislation was due to be discussed by the House of Lords on Monday, but the Conservatives have sought to stall it, saying it would breach a treaty with the US. Last week, President Trump criticised the deal. Our political correspondent Leila Nathu reports.
Under the terms of the government's proposed Chagos deal with Mauritius, the UK will lease back Diego Garcia, the largest of the islands, and home to a shared UK-US military base. The Conservatives claim passing the bill ratifying the deal would put the UK in contravention of a 1966 treaty agreed with the US over the islands. Last night, the Tories put down a motion to try to stall the bill's progress through Parliament until agreement is reached with the US over the treaty. Last month, the government said it was in talks with Washington over updating it. The White House initially backed the deal, but earlier this week, Donald Trump called it an act of great stupidity. Monday's debate in the Lords will not now go ahead. Government sources say they're considering their response and the legislation will return at a later date. Government spokesperson said it was fully committed to the Chagos deal and accused Conservative peers of reckless and irresponsible behaviour in interfering with national security priorities. The Tories said they would continue to fight the deal.
Russia has launched more air raids on Ukraine overnight after the first direct talks involving the two sides and the US on President Trump's plan to end the war. The Ukrainian authorities said the strikes killed one person and wounded at least 15 others in Kyiv and the northeastern city of Kharkiv. The peace talks in Abu Dhabi are due to continue today. The Ukrainian political analyst Peter Zalmayev says people in the country have mixed feelings on the talks.
They're not getting their hopes up. What, you know, gets their hopes up is that, you know, Zelensky and Trump agreed on a continued shipments of American Patriot missiles to help Ukraine in this very dark and cold season. We'll take all the help we can get.
The US has published its new national defence strategy, signalling more limited support for allies such as Europe and South Korea. The document says the top priorities are defending the US homeland and deterring China in the Indo-Pacific. It calls for increased burden sharing with allies, saying that other nations should take primary responsibility for defence in their own region. The government says ministers will be given new powers to intervene in failing police forces in England and Wales as part of a package of measures to be announced next week. The Home Secretary, Shabana Mahmood, promised the action after the controversy over the decision by West Midlands Police to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv from a football match in Birmingham last year. The row led to the retirement of the force's chief constable. Current rules, which prevent ministers from intervening directly, will be changed, as our senior UK correspondent Seema Katecha reports.
Police forces are currently not directly accountable to politicians. Ministers can't sack failing police leaders or instruct forces to improve. As part of the government's white paper on policing to be unveiled on Monday, ministers will be given new powers to send in specialist teams to turn around problematic forces. For example, if crime-solving rates or police response times are poor, experts from the best-performing forces will be sent to try to improve performance. There'll be new laws enabling the government to force the retirement, resignation or suspension of chief constables. And how a force is meeting new targets or neighbourhood policing levels, 999 response times and crime outcome rates will be published and used to grade them. The Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood says this will drive up standards, but some senior officers have told the BBC putting control into the hands of politicians undermines their leadership.
The proposals will also introduce a licence to practice for police officers in England and Wales, modelled on the system used for lawyers and doctors. Ministers say officers will have to renew their licences throughout their careers to demonstrate that they have the skills needed to fight crime. Those who fail to reach the required standard will be dismissed. NHS England is launching a new database which patients can search to see if they're at risk of developing cancer. The register contains 120 genes known to increase the likelihood of getting the disease. The charity Breast Cancer Now says the system could transform lives. The Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has until 5 o'clock this afternoon to decide whether to stand in the Gaunton and Denton by-election. The seat in Greater Manchester is vacant after the former Labour Minister Andrew Gwynne stood down on health grounds. Winning there would allow Mr Burnham to return to Westminster as an MP and potentially mount a leadership challenge to Keir Starmer. But as an elected mayor, he would need permission from Labour's ruling National Executive Committee to contest the by-election. Gemma Bolton, who represents constituency members on the NEC, told Newsnight that it would be outrageous if Mr Burnham was blocked.
I think it's right for the members of the constituency to get to decide who represents them. And if they want that to be Andy Burnham, then they should be able to vote for him. And the whole conversation currently needs to be about who is the strongest candidate to win in Gaunton and Denton. And that's clearly going to be the popular Labour mayor of Manchester.
Police in the US city of Minneapolis have arrested around 100 members of the clergy at a demonstration against federal immigration raids. The protest at the city's main airport was part of a day of action which saw thousands take to the streets. Here's our North America correspondent David Willis.
The fatal shooting of a US citizen earlier this month and the detention this week of a 5-year-old boy have inflamed tensions with federal immigration officials who've been deployed to Minneapolis in their thousands. A sit-in and prayer service at the Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport in protest at deportation flights led to the arrest of the religious leaders as thousands braved sub-zero temperatures to join a separate demonstration thought to be the largest display of opposition to the current immigration policy that the state of Minnesota has seen so far. The Trump administration has claimed that more than 10,000 undocumented immigrants have been arrested in Minneapolis as part of its recent crackdown there.
The fourth series of the hit BBC show The Traitors has come to a dramatic end after 3 weeks of murders, betrayals and backstabbing. There was a final prize pot of almost £100,000. And if you haven't watched it yet, you might want to turn your radio down during this report by our culture correspondent Noor Nanji, which contains spoilers.
This series has been characterised by several twists on the original formula, which have increased the drama in the castle and seem to have gone down well with audiences. At the start of a nail-biting final, traitor Rachel survived banishment at the expense of faithful James. That left just 5 players in the game, from 22 at the start. But in the end, it was Rachel and fellow traitor Stephen who were crowned the winners. The first time 2 traitors have been victorious.
To the traitors.
To the traitors!
I've been dying to say that.
The winners share a prize pot of £95,750. This comes just a few months after a hugely successful celebrity spin-off featuring Alan Carr and Sir Stephen Fry. The show has become a cultural phenomenon, with millions of viewers tuning in every night. It has also succeeded in drawing in younger audiences and led to watch parties in homes and pubs across the UK.
That was our culture correspondent, Noor Nanji, and hopefully you've turned us back on by now.
I hope so too. Otherwise, Alan, we're just talking to each other. It's 7:09. Let's tell you a bit more about that NHS database, if you picked up on that in the news bulletin. For over 120 genes linked to cancer has been created and will enable tens of thousands of patients to check on this database whether they could be at risk of developing the disease. It sounds pretty life-changing and, as NHS England have put it, life-saving. Professor Peter Johnson, the National Clinical Director for Cancer at NHS England, joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Emma.
How does this work? What have you created?
Well, we offer people a lot of tests to check for their susceptibility to cancer for a variety of genes, genes like BRCA and things like the Lynch syndrome. And what we've done now is pull all that together into a single register so that we can contact people to offer them screening and in some cases offer them preventative treatments. So people who have Lynch syndrome, which predisposes them to bowel cancer, for example, can take aspirin. We offer them colonoscopies. And next year, we're going to start a trial of a vaccine to see if we can prevent them developing their cancers. So lots of opportunities, not only for more surveillance, but also for some early interventions for people who have these abnormalities.
Is there a reason why this is only becoming available now?
It's really us bringing together all the data that we have and making sure that our information systems work. Obviously, you need to be sure that it's incredibly confidential and secure, and also that it really works. So we've been doing that and bringing that together. And this is all part of what we're trying to do in the upcoming cancer plan to help people to understand what their risk of cancer is and enable them to act on that.
Do you think people, I mean, you'll know, what is it like for people to come forward, to get them to come forward on the availability you've already got there, as you mentioned, about the BRCA gene? Are you expecting people to take NHS England up on this?
Yes, we've been running a programme for a couple of years now, and particularly targeted at people with Jewish grandparents, because we know that they have an increased risk of carrying abnormalities in the BRCA gene. And we've seen a lot of people come forward. Tens of thousands of people have come forward for testing, and we've identified several hundred people who have this abnormality. It's obviously very daunting, because you know that if an abnormality in this gene is identified, that you are at greater risk. But of course, knowing about it enables you to take the necessary measures and to be aware of any risk of the cancer developing so that we can pick it up as early as possible.
And this is, when is this available? How will it be activated? How can you access it?
We're already doing the testing. We've been testing for these genes for some time. We're doing it more and more. At the moment, we've got a big program to find the people with BRCA abnormalities who haven't been picked up previously. So we're going back in time, looking at those. And the process is already underway, but the central register is being set up, as I say, as part of the cancer plan in the next few months, so that we can really start to contact people prospectively.
So it'll be proactive to contact people at first?
Yes, so people who have got these abnormalities will be contacted to make sure that they've got the offer of screening, to make sure that they understand the risk and what to do about it.
And this is a world first, is that right?
This is the first time that any healthcare system has brought together all the information about all the genetic risk into a single place. And there are obvious advantages to doing that, which is the efficiency with which we can do it and making sure that we can keep tabs on people and offer them things as they develop. And as I say, new things like a vaccination program against Lynch, which is just going to get started with a few people next year to make sure it's safe and it works. If that's successful, then having this register will enable us to offer it to a lot of people much more rapidly than would otherwise be the case.
I think we should say good luck in the respect of the ambition of it and what you're trying to do, because that life-saving element is huge, isn't it?
It is, yes. As I say, we think this will give us opportunities both for prevention of cancer and also to make sure that if it does occur, that we're picking it up as early as possible.
Professor Peter Johnson, National Clinical Director for Cancer at NHS England, thank you.
It's 14 minutes past seven. Now, the first trilateral talks to try to end the war in Ukraine, those talks between the US, Ukraine and Russia, have been described as productive by American sources. They will continue today in Abu Dhabi. Sarah Rainsford is our correspondent in Kyiv. Sarah, that said, productive, as usual, it hasn't stopped Russian missile attacks on Ukraine overnight.
No, I heard somebody say yesterday that generally there was a pause in attacks when talks were going on, but that clearly isn't true because about 1:30 in the morning, the air raid alarms went off and the missile threat warnings started coming in. So last night there was one person killed and four people injured here in Kyiv and more people injured in Kharkiv, more people left without heating and without electricity in their houses here in Ukraine's capital. Again, it seems like Russia was targeting the civilian infrastructure here, the civilian heating and power infrastructure in cities across Ukraine, which is deliberate and which is clearly meant to freeze people here into submission. That's quite clearly what Ukraine says is happening, and it's what many people I've been speaking to here believe too. They feel like this is a deliberate kind of punishment for them for refusing to surrender to Russia and to what it wants. And of course, those hardline positions have been presented again at the talks in Abu Dhabi, where Russia has said it wants all of that land in the eastern Donbass that it hasn't yet captured by force to be handed over by Ukraine, essentially for free, which Ukraine is saying it can't and it won't do.
Yeah. So what do you think, Sarah, is a possible way through that? As you say, it's one of the key sticking points in this US-backed deal. And they have very much been on the side of Russia. They're asking Ukraine to make the sort of concessions that they're not very keen to make in terms of that land. Is there a way through?
Yeah, I think not very keen is probably an understatement, isn't it? I mean, if you just think about how many soldiers' lives have been lost fighting to defend that land, you talk to people here and they say there's no way they want to just hand that over. If Russia hasn't won that, conquered that territory, then why should they should be gifted it? So it's very difficult. And certainly Vladimir Zelensky knows that that is something that would be extremely unpopular. If he accepted it, it would be seen as a form of capitulation. So the talks, I think, will be very, very difficult on that and on other aspects too, because, you know, we don't really know what Russia will say to other areas of the peace deal that Ukraine and the United States have kind of hammered out agreement between themselves on. So I think it's important that the three sides are sitting down in Abu Dhabi. It's important that there's a conversation going on, but I think it's going to be a very long and a very complicated one. And talking to Ukrainians here, the general kind of consensus is that they don't believe at this point Vladimir Putin genuinely wants peace, because if he did want peace, then they don't think he would be sending his missiles slamming into their power stations and their homes.
Sarah Rainsford, our correspondent in Kyiv, thank you.
It's 17 minutes past seven. The government has been forced to pull a House of Lords debate aimed at enshrining in law its Chagos deal. The Conservatives have long opposed the deal to give the Chagos Islands to Mauritius, but the move comes days after Donald Trump called it an act of great stupidity. Billy Kemba is the BBC political correspondent who's joined us in the studio. Why has this happened, Billy? Is it to do with Trump? Is it to do with the Conservatives?
Well, the short answer is it was due for debate on Monday, and the Conservatives took the opportunity shortly before the close of the session on Friday to table a wrecking amendment, and the government doesn't have a majority in the House of Lords, so fearful it would lose the vote, it's decided to pull the debate for now. The broader context is obviously those Trump remarks earlier in the week, and whether they call into question, as they surely must, the US's support for the deal. It's signed off on the deal last year when it was all announced. But there are technical aspects to it that are still ongoing and that are going to require the US's consent. So the Conservatives seize an opportunity here to continue their opposition to this to this deal, but also to perhaps make a political point.
And I suppose, does that mean, I mean, what does that mean in terms of the future of this policy? Will it go ahead or will they find another way? Can they find another way, the government?
Well, the government will, government sources are adamant that they are committed to this deal, that this will come back up for debate and that there will be methods found to block a Reckon amendment second time round. In practice, they're going to need to call on the support of the Lib Dems and crossbench peers to get this one through in the House of Lords. And then at the same time, we will have to see what happens in that wider geopolitical issue of whether the US's support has now been withdrawn.
Indeed. Billy Kemba, our political correspondent, thanks for putting us in the picture.
19 minutes past seven, the House of Lords spent another day yesterday in Parliament looking in detail at how the assisted dying bill might work in practice. In particular, they discussed whether the NHS would be the right organisation to run any new service. This law, if and when it might happen, would allow adults in England and Wales to request help to die if they were considered to have less than 6 months left to live. It's our parliamentary correspondent, Susan Hume.
The NHS is always under pressure, so the non-party peer Lord Burt feared accessing an assisted death in the health service could be a long and tricky process. He had a suggestion of how to make that journey easier.
An assisted dying help service that would provide a personal navigator to take the dying person and their loved ones through the whole complex process, providing introductions, keeping to timelines, piloting the individual through their final challenging and traumatic journey.
But a Conservative Lord Harper thought people should be helped to navigate their way to other options too.
If palliative care isn't available to you in the normal course of events, this person can also help you seek that rather than only being able to help you seek assisted suicide.
An independent peer, Lady Fox, thought a navigator to help people through the thicket of services sounded great, but again, not just for assisted deaths.
Those people on trolleys, those people waiting for operations, those people trying to find their way into the care system, can we all have one? And if we don't afford every patient in the country a personal navigator, isn't that an unequal access to services?
The non-party peer Lord Stevens, who used to be chief executive of NHS England, said the core purpose of the health service was treatment. He didn't want to see an assisted dying service being part of the NHS at all.
It increases the risk of what you might call self-coercion in the name of altruism. People thinking that not only by reducing the burden on their families, but the burden on the NHS from an earlier death is a very genuine risk.
But a Conservative and former Health Minister, Lord Markham, said choices were made all the time about what the NHS should fund.
Whether we put more funding into cancer, whether we put more funding into other services, it's entirely appropriate. And I believe one of the key phrases was, it is our NHS. Our NHS. And what do we know about assisted dying that 70% of the public supported?
The bill's being steered through the Lords by Labour's Lord Faulkner. He didn't agree with Lord Burt's plan to make it easier and quicker to get an assisted death. He thought the checks and time for reflection included in the bill now were necessary safeguards. But as for the idea that the NHS should not be involved in helping someone to die...
For my own part, providing somebody with an assisted death, if properly safeguarded, is providing them with a good death, if that is what they want.
And Lord Faulkner said he believed providing people with the best death they could have was certainly what the NHS should be doing. And the debate continues next Friday.
Susan Hume reporting there. Now, at 22 minutes past seven, let's turn our attention far from Parliament and to spring and to something of old, but also of the present. Many of us will be looking forward to spring. Of course, we are. It's January. But one social enterprise in West Yorkshire has been encouraging residents to embrace the winter months by hosting wassails. The ancient English tradition dates back to 1585 and involves celebrating orchards with hot apple juice and songs and blessing the trees in the hope of a good harvest. It's the latest project by the Fruitworks team, who run events all year round to help people discover the food and nature growing in their community. Katie Hazeldine went along to the Wassail in Leeds.
So let's do a call and response and then see if we can just loop it.
It's a dark, cold, wet January evening, but here at Meanwood Valley Urban Farm in Leeds, there's some light, warmth and joy.
Oh, apple, apple tree!
Oh, apple, apple tree!
We have come to wassail thee!
We have come to wassail thee!
A wassail is taking place.
Will you bear some fruit for me?
When the season changes!
When the season changes!
My name's Trills and I work for Fruitworks Cooperative, which is a small social enterprise in Leeds and Bradford, and we do everything fruit tree related.
Dozens of people have turned up to enjoy the bonfire and the apple juice squeezed from the fruits of the trees planted in the community.
So tonight was a wassail, which is an ancient English tradition from the Anglo-Saxon times where people would gather in their orchards and be with their neighbours and sing songs and have these evenings of debauchery, and they'd bless the trees and ask for a good harvest for the year to come. So we're trying to like bring back some of that spirit of being in tune with the land and your neighbours.
Let's do the microphone thing again. So now that we've cheersed each other, we're going to cheers the trees. So that cup of juice that you've got, I want you to pour it on the roots of the trees.
How does an event like this fit into that wider mission that you have?
A big part of our vision is like getting people connecting with nature and kind of knowing where our food comes from and being interested in like food cycles and getting people out for like a community event that's like a bit rough around the edges and like shouting really loud at people that you don't know, you know, just shouting into the night and singing songs, and that stuff is really good for us on like a very deep level. And it's not just like a fringe subculture that's here, you know, it's like families, people of all ages.
How old are you?
69.
We've got 69. Anyone got higher?
80.
Oh, we've got 80. 80.
Oh. My name's Ed.
Have you ever been to a wassail before?
No, I haven't. It was good fun. We like being in the fresh air anyway. I didn't see any goats coming, though. I was looking. When I was little, I was in Africa then, and they didn't do things like this. So this is nice for me.
And haven't we got a very young person?
We've got four.
Oh, yes!
Can you tell me what your name is?
Erin.
You've been holding that pan all night. Tell me what you've been doing with that pan.
I've been holding it and tapping it with a spoon.
Have you ever been to anything like this before?
No, it's good.
What did you like about it?
I liked about it because there were twinkling lights on the trees.
You're going to go and have a drink of apple juice?
Yeah.
Oh, what a sweetheart she was. Exactly the kind of warmth and joy you need in the middle of a very cold and miserable January that's going on and on and on. That's Katie Hazeldine reporting from Leeds.
And let's get the latest now from the sports world. If you've been in, inspired by the music, we'll get to the physicality. Sarah Orchard's here with the latest at 26 minutes past seven.
Yes, a very good morning to you. Right, there was a significant draw for West Bromwich Albion in the Championship last night. 1-1 it finished away at Derby County, meaning the visitors stopped their 10-match losing streak. There's more of that. And of course, a tense win for Prem champions Bath at Gloucester and Rugby Union, all on the BBC Sport website. And later this morning, we'll pick through Steve Borthwick's England Six Nations squad. But our focus now is Melbourne and the Australian Open, where play was suspended earlier today when the heat rule was invoked. Well, let's head to Melbourne now and speak to our air-conditioned tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller. Good morning, Russell.
Good morning, Sarah.
Now, there is so much to cover here. We will talk about tennis, but we do have to talk about the heat first of all. What happened earlier?
Around about 3 hours into play, the temperature in Melbourne got a little bit too hot and the Australian Open's extreme heat policy kicked in. And that meant that on the outside courts, where there is not a roof over most of the courts, play was suspended. And on the three show courts that do have a roof, play was interrupted temporarily for around about 10 minutes while they closed the roof and readied the arenas. Play is still suspended on the outside courts. We've had temperatures that have peaked at 38.5 degrees Celsius, and a British junior was one of the casualties, having to retire with cramp from her match after nearly 3 hours on court.
And Russell, when it comes to this, Jannik Sinner, I mean, he's the reigning champion right now. He came through his third round match, but the heat almost saved him because it did impact the Italian.
He is very grateful to the Australian Open's heat policy because he was level at one set all with an unseeded American by the name of Elliot Spizzieri, but was 3-1 down in the third set and was starting to cramp. And at that moment, the heat stress scale reached the magic number of 5, which led to the suspension of play, or in the case of this match, because it was on the Rod Laver Arena, the closing of the roof. And he was still struggling after that, Sinner. He wasn't comfortable either physically or with Spizzieri's game, but he came through in 4 sets, and therefore his chance to win a third consecutive title here remains intact.
And coming up later today, Novak Djokovic, Naomi Osaka, are they the headliners?
Novak Djokovic, I think, will hope it remains too hot for at least another hour so that the roof remains closed for his match against Botik van der Zandschulp of the Netherlands. No direct sun in the evening, but still very, very hot. Not clever when you're a 38-year-old, even if you are a 10-time champion here. And Naomi Osaka, also in the night session, will play the Australian qualifier, Madison Inglis, who's got through to the third round.
And before I let you go, Russell, I listened to the BBC Tennis podcast on the way in this morning. If you could just give us some headlines after Cam Norrie went out yesterday about the underperforming Brits.
It was a disappointing event for the singles players. 7 in the draw. They managed only 4 wins between them. I mean, in all honesty, Sara, there are 3 players in Britain at the moment who've proven that they can go quite deep into a Grand Slam. Cameron Norrie, who did reach the third round before losing to the world number 3, Alex Zverev. Emma Raducanu, who lost in the second round and is a bit of out of sorts at the moment and seemingly in 2 minds about how she wants to play the game. And Jack Draper, who is injured and hoping to return for Britain's Davis Cup tie against Norway and Oslo at the beginning of February.
Well, Russell Fuller, our tennis correspondent, thank you for your time this morning. There's more from Russell and the team in Melbourne on Tennis Breakfast right now on BBC Sounds on Sports Extra.
Thank you, Sarah. It's 7:30 now. Let's see what Paddy O'Connell's got to tell us about tomorrow's edition of Broadcasting House.
Hello. After a bone-shaking ride on the news cycle, we'll unpick the pieces of the Western Alliance. Ed Sturton tells us Donald Trump is copying historic US presidents, and Poland's foreign minister adds up the growing bill for Europe's defence. We talk about mothers-in-law who are back in the news over Victoria Beckham's behaviour at her son's wedding. We'll join a police officer on the beat ahead of a giant reorganisation. We celebrate Burns Night, and there's some talk about cats in pubs. BH is on BBC Sounds and on air from 9 here on BBC Radio 4.
That's 9 tomorrow morning with Burns Night, cats and mother-in-laws. What more could you wish for? What a menu. It's at 29 minutes to 8, I can tell you, with a look at the weather for today. Rain in the southeast and northeast Scotland and generally dry elsewhere. Windy, apparently.
Plenty to look forward to there, isn't there? It really is. It's just after 7:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London, Anna Foster in Salford, and Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
A parliamentary debate on the government's deal to hand back the Chagos Islands to Mauritius has been delayed. The legislation was due to be discussed by the House of Lords on Monday, but the Conservatives have moved to stall it, saying it would breach a treaty with the US. Last week, President Trump criticised the deal. One person has been killed and at least 15 others have been injured in Russian air raids on Ukraine overnight. The attacks came after the first direct talks involving Kyiv, Moscow and Washington on President Trump's plan to end the war. The peace talks in Abu Dhabi are expected to continue today. Ministers will be given new powers to intervene in failing police forces in England and Wales as part of a new package of measures to be announced by the government next week. The Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood promised action after the controversy over the decision by West Midlands Police to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a football match in Birmingham last year. New laws will enable the government to force the retirement, resignation or suspension of underperforming chief constables. NHS England is introducing a new genetic database to help patients assess their risk of cancer. It contains details of 120 genes associated with the disease. Family members of cancer patients could have their genes compared to the database, allowing for earlier screening and more personalised treatments. The Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has until 5pm today to decide whether to run in the Gorton and Denton by-election. Winning the seat would allow him to return to Westminster and potentially challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the party leadership. But as a sitting mayor, he'd need permission from Labour's ruling body to contest the by-election. And part of the main railway line through Devon has been closed until this afternoon because of a rare black alert issued for Storm Ingrid. 12-foot high waves are expected at Dawlish, where a storm destroyed sections of the track 12 years ago.
Alan, thanks very much. 27 minutes to eight. We have heard from and seen a great deal of Donald Trump on the international stage over the last week as rhetoric ratcheted up over his designs on Greenland, posing what was described as one of the greatest threats to the North Atlantic Alliance in the post-war era before a climb down on Thursday. But how are his actions on the world stage moving the dial, if at all, back home in the US and impacting how the average American views him, especially ahead of those key midterms in November? I've been speaking to Simon D. Schuster, a Capitol reporter for Bridge Michigan, a news organisation in the swing state of Michigan.
To be frank, the voters in Michigan don't, while they factor in foreign affairs and certainly have been paying attention to what's been going on the international stage, it's not the sort of thing that will be influencing their vote come November. Something about 3% of voters consider immigration and border control or these international issues something that's going to really influence their vote heading into November. But as far as the bevy of other issues such as jobs and the economy, taxes, the cost of living, it's quite far down the list.
And how is he doing on those things?
Not particularly well, I have to say. His approval rating, his job approval in Michigan is hovering somewhere south of 40% at present. And that's in part because confidence in the economy among Michiganders compared to this time last year is about 30% lower than it was. They've noticed things that essentially can't be spun away with convincing rhetoric, that when they go to the grocery store, prices are higher, utility bills for things like electricity are increasing, and some of the promises he's made, such as bringing down the cost of housing, those haven't come to pass either.
Do you think there's time to turn that around, or what do you think that will mean in terms of how people cast their vote with their feet?
To hear elected Republicans speak to this, they are saying that people need to be patient, and that when his landmark tax and spending bill, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, sort of comes into full force, that there will be a bevy of funding cuts coming. But part of the difficulty that he has is that Trump visited Michigan many times in 2024. And at Bridge here, we tracked something like 100 of some of the promises that he's made. And some of them are very difficult, if not impossible, to achieve. They include cutting electricity bill costs by 50% within 12 months. That certainly hasn't come to pass. Paying for free in vitro fertilization treatments, and even bringing back automotive jobs, the likes of which we haven't seen in this state in 30 or 40 years. So he really does have his work coming out for him.
That was Simon D. Schuster giving an insight to the voters he knows around him in Michigan and those he's been speaking to and what's been going on. Tom Lubbock is listening to that, co-founder of the polling company JL Partners. Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
How does the polling look when it comes to Donald Trump's popularity and success at the moment?
I think we heard some of the polling mentioned there. But if you look at those averages that put Trump's approval at about 41-42%, those are from the same polling organizations that would have made Kamala Harris president, in that they were predicting that result back in November of 2024. So I think we should take them with a pinch of salt. I think the direction of travel is clear. Like all modern presidents, Donald Trump has suffered, his approval rating has suffered over the first 12 months of his term. But what the absolute level is, I think there's still some question marks about.
And in terms of what's driving it, what can you say on that? And you know, the foreign policy interventions, because it didn't sound certainly in Michigan that those things are impactful in the way that they might be coming across to us here.
Yeah, I think, look, there was an imperious kind of first 6 months of political strategy from the Trump team. But since then, there have been some real missteps. I think the secular trends that we've seen impact incumbents across the last kind of 5-6 years of high prices really just impacting on all political leaders, whether they produce growth or not. And that's the really interesting thing about the Trump administration. He's managed to produce growth, but has still suffered from this kind of cost of living affordability crisis as he starts to own the economy. I think the ICE raids have become a real problem for him. I don't know what the thinking was behind that originally. But
the pictures of the protests just alone, if people have not seen them, are worth checking out, aren't they? I mean, in very cold conditions, people are taking to the streets.
Yeah, I think, look, Americans have wanted their borders secured for a long time. And I think it's hard for the British psyche to understand where the average American is on borders policy. But this has strayed into a different territory. And I think if you look at Republican views of ICE, the approval rating is down 15 points over 12 months. And that, to me, says something's gone wrong there for the administration.
And how did the approval rating, where he is now, just to say that again, how does that compare to other presidents at a similar time in their term?
I think what's really interesting, Emma, is that Trump is an extraordinary president in so many ways. But he is a very ordinary second-term modern president in terms of his approval rating. It has fallen. It has gradually declined. He looks like Obama or Bush in terms of that approval rating. The big question is, can he turn it around before the midterms? Midterms have proved kryptonite for modern presidents, going back all the way to kind of Jimmy Carter. They've proved really challenging. There's very likely to be more bad news coming in the midterms. But that first 6 months of the Trump administration with that political strategy that looked imperious really does make me wonder whether they've got something up their sleeve.
Well, we shall see. It has been quite a week and the week before as well in terms of what we've been looking at on the international side. Tom Lubbock there, co-founder of the polling company JL Partners. And before, it was very interesting to hear from Simon D. Schuster, a reporter from Michigan.
It's just coming around to 7:40. The comedian Matt Ford has posted a really uplifting message on social media about his cancer recovery from 13 hours of major surgery that changed his body forever. He's now been back to the gym for the first time in years. He's about to start a 51-date UK tour, and he joins us. Morning, Matt.
Good morning, Anna.
Just easing yourself in gently with that tour. I see. Taking it slow.
I'm exhausted this morning. I can't wait to get back out on the road. And I never thought actually I'd be able to go to the gym again. I just thought, you know, having the base of my spine removed after I was diagnosed with chordoma, a rare form of spinal cancer, and the impact that it had on my body, bladder and bowel, I've now got a colostomy bag, I have to self-catheterise. And obviously, if you have major spinal surgery, you have the base of it removed. I wasn't sure I'd be able to walk again, really. So to be able to get back in the gym, to be able to do cardio, I wasn't aware yesterday when I turned up for that session at the Royal National Orthopaedic with my amazing physio, Laura, that I was actually going to be doing the sorts of things I was doing. I actually can't believe, you know, and I'm more than 2 years clear now and having been discharged. I just can't believe that my body can do that. So it was just a real lesson in, you know, you lie there in a hospital bed sometimes, often in a lot of pain and despair, and you wonder what your future's going to be like. But progress can happen slowly. And even a couple of years after being discharged, there are still amazing surprises that life can give you.
Yeah. And, you know, you've been so open about the whole, I don't want to say journey, the whole cancer journey, but the fact that you have, you've talked about it, you've probably told people things that they didn't know beforehand. So actually it feels right when you have a moment like this to share that as well.
I think so. And I think in life, often we're very quick to complain if things are wrong and to use social media for, you know, effectively consumer affairs issues with bus companies or whatever. So I always think if you're enjoying something or something's gone well, you should share it, mainly because prior to my surgery, I was worried, and I'm an optimistic person, but I was worried about what my future was going to be like. I didn't know what having a stoma was going to be like and having to self-catheterize and all these things. And they've been so easy to deal with. I'm not minimizing the problems that they have caused, but in the grand scheme of things, there's such a small price to pay. So I think really for people like me that were going into surgery like that, I think if you're going into anything big, it's not that you're going to get everything back, but you get yourself to a point where you're really happy that the worst is over and that there's still so much you can do in life.
Yeah. And there'll be at least one, probably many more than one person who saw that yesterday, who's actually in the position that you were at the start, who will look at that and that just little bit of hope and inspiration, that'll have meant a lot to them.
Well, I hope so. And I think the other thing I would say is, even when it's really difficult, there are still amazing moments. I was in hospital for 10 weeks, and three of those weeks were spent in levels of pain that I can't believe the body can endure. And I was really terrified that that was going to be the rest of my life. And it was horrendous. But even in those days, when I was in more pain than I ever thought was possible, there were still moments of levity, and I was still being cared for and loved by, you know, my amazing wife and family and friends and staff. So even, you know, obviously once it clears, it feels so good. But even in the middle of a crisis, that there are still moments where you can enjoy life. And I think life is difficult. And I've come to realise I'm sort of quite unusually positive, and I can't fully explain where that comes from. But I've obviously had that tested, and I still feel good on the other side of it.
Yeah, we all need more of that, I think. And also, I think it's really interesting as well, you wrote in that post about some of the things that you lost, but also some of the things that you've gained as well, and ways in which you're now fitter and healthier than you were beforehand.
Definitely, because having the stoma has really made me think about what I eat and when I eat. Having had cancer has definitely made me think more about what I put in my body anyway. And I would never have done weight and conditioning training. I always thought it was for basically vain people who wanted six packs. And they're not necessarily bad people. I realise society has changed. But I always just thought, oh, I'll just run until I'm tired. That was my sort of exercise. Whereas now I think, oh, I actually do need to build a bit of muscle. It's good for bone density. So, and I would not have been doing this had I not had cancer. So I guess you could argue that I'm now healthier for having had spinal cancer than I was before it.
Yeah, and this one trip to the gym is going to have to turn into regular trips to the gym, presumably, because 51 dates. I mean, I know it starts, what, 28th of January, the tour, and how long does it go on for?
It goes on until June, the end of June.
Ooh.
So it's grueling, yeah.
It really is.
I'm going to have to look after myself. So it's not going to be, people think that touring's rock and roll and like you go, I just finish the show, go to the hotel, have a bath and go to sleep. So I'm not
it sounds
as
quite calming. And also eating as well. When you travel a lot, eating's an absolute nightmare, isn't it? Just trying to be, you know, those healthy habits that you were saying you've picked up, just trying to keep those.
Well, and especially with having a colostomy bag, because you're not in control of it in the same way. So part of the way that I've been able to lose weight is I was so terrified of the bag being active when I was on stage that I would just eat less. So now my weight is, I mean, I used to, you don't realise it until you look back on photos. I was a heavy lad not that long ago. And now I think I've become mildly obsessional about it. You know, I weigh myself every morning and I'm just aware of what I put in. So again, it's arguably made me healthier.
Matt, tell us about the tour before you go, because you're up and very lively at 7:45 on a Saturday morning.
Thank
so the least
much.
We can do is put a bit of that in before we go.
Thank you so much. It's called Defying Calamity, and it's lots of topical stuff, the usual stuff I do, impressions of Donald Trump and Keir Starmer and Angela Rayner and Oasis and all that sort of thing, plus stuff about the changes to my body and dealing with recovering from cancer surgery. So it's a bit the personal and the political, and it's obviously hilarious. It's the funniest comedy show around. And
Matt,
I should say, Anna, I'm a massive fan of the Today Show, and it is an honour to be on, and I'm a massive fan of you both, and it is the best broadcast journalism on the planet. There is no other show like this anywhere in the world, and it is just, I start every morning by listening to it. You're the best.
Oh, thanks, Matt. We'll get that fiver in the post. That's much appreciated. And good luck with the tour. Good. We'll slip it to 10, maybe. Matt, it's brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so, so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. Good luck with the tour.
Yes.
Take care. That's Matt Ford.
Keep that man talking, I say.
Any way we can sort of clip that and add it to the CV? That's quite useful.
If only we
need to hang on to those.
If only we worked at a broadcasting company and knew how to clip things. Right, well, there you go, perhaps. Matt Ford was lovely to hear there. That sort of recovery, I've really followed what he's talked about, especially with pain and what the body can endure. But now at 7:48, let's have a moment for thought for the day. The speaker today, the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Well in Garden City.
Good morning. The pub in Oxford last week looked its usual amazing self. I'd been doing a bit of teaching and I was staying in a nearby college overnight. Now, outside it was dark, it was cold and it was wet. But as I pushed the pub door open, I was met with a warm, candlelit cacophony of conversation. People were eating supper, they were playing board games, reading books. It was a glorious, uplifting sight. We know that for decades now, pub landlords have been facing multiple challenges in order simply to keep their doors open. In 2025, the equivalent of one pub a day in England and Wales had to close its doors permanently. So it was great this week to hear Prince William talking about how much he loves everything a pub has to offer. and urging us all to do all that we can to support our local. Pubs, he said, are the beating heart of many communities where we can meet with friends and neighbours. Along with churches and other places of worship, many of which are also reimagining themselves simply to survive, pubs provide a radical alternative to the social isolation and loneliness affecting many groups in society. I observe this more and more in the course of my work. Often unseen, people of all ages and backgrounds can unwittingly find themselves alone, without the means or motivation to find a non-transactional space where they can simply be with other people. And many community cafes are also thriving like never before. Christian theology has always celebrated hospitality. The Bible stresses the importance of people being together to meet, as well as sharing food and drink. And this is something that Jesus is also frequently found to be doing in the Gospels as he meets with an interesting range of people. St. Paul, who the church remembers tomorrow, wrote many letters to the early church, stressing not only the importance of worship, but also the spiritual benefits that fellowship with other people can bring. He regards this as an important ingredient towards spiritual renewal and happiness. For centuries now, pubs have been at the centre of British culture. The Catholic writer Hilaire Belloc warned, "When you've lost your inns, drown your empty cells, for you will have lost the last of England." They've left their mark throughout literature, in Orwell and Dickens, Dylan Thomas and Chaucer. Indeed, his pilgrims began their journey to Canterbury at the Tabard Inn. So as modern-day pilgrims, navigating an ever-complex world of conundrums and challenges, wherever our final destination might be, preserving just some spaces for conversation and friendship where strangers might become friends is surely an imperative.
That was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Canon Dr. Rob Marshall, Rector of Digswell, Welwyn Garden City. It's 11 minutes to 8.
Andy Burnham will have to decide by 5 o'clock this afternoon if he wants to quit as Greater Manchester Mayor and run to be an MP again instead, which would give him the ability, should he choose to do so, to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the Labour leadership. All of this, of course, is if he's not blocked from standing for that vacant seat. The power is in the hands of the National Executive Committee because he is an elected mayor. Henry Zeffman, our chief political correspondent, with us. Morning, Henry.
Good morning.
This is all happening quite quickly. You get the sense that Labour don't want this to be an issue that that drags on.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I think they want to have this row, and I think it is going to become a row, an even bigger row than it is this morning, as quickly as possible, and then move on. I mean, as you say, a decision will be made after 5 p.m. today by Labour's ruling National Executive. That's a body of about 40 people, but the decision is going to be made by 10 officers, as they are known. Like the National Executive Committee as a whole, they are pretty strongly pro Keir Starmer and pro the Labour leadership. We don't yet know for sure that Andy Burnham will apply, but assuming he does, and I think most people are assuming he does, we still expect this group of officers to vote to block him. Now, worth saying, their reasoning probably wouldn't explicitly be about the possibility that he wants to become Labour leader. It would probably focus on the disruption which would be caused to the Labour Party by a by-election for the Greater Manchester mayoralty, which is held since 2017. We reckon that would cost about £4.7 million of public money to run, and that's before you get to Labour's concern about campaign resources. I mean, of course, the person we still haven't heard from in all of this is Andy Burnham, and it's Labour's North West Conference, by coincidence, this weekend. Not clear if he's still planning to attend, but I think we expect to hear from him in one form or another before long.
Yeah. So as you described there, Henry, there's the politics in the mix. There are some legitimate points as well. But if he is blocked from standing, from being chosen, because obviously they'll have to longlist and shortlist first, what would Labour MPs think about that?
Well, I think those who don't want him to become leader or those who simply do not want this row would be happy. And that's probably a plurality of Labour MPs who have a view on this. But I think some Labour MPs would be very, very annoyed, to say the least. I mean, we've already had some MPs complain publicly. Perhaps most importantly, Angela Rayner, the former deputy leader, has let it be known that she does not believe that Andy Burnham should be blocked. I mean, it is just worth stating out loud, the implicit logic of potentially blocking him is that those around Keir Starmer have decided that a row over blocking him which could further dent Keir Starmer's standing among some MPs, is less bad for them than having him on the back benches within a few months, ready to challenge Keir Starmer for the leadership when he wants to. I was speaking to one Labour MP who hasn't publicly complained about this, who said to me, if we're honestly saying the Prime Minister believes that if Andy Burnham were an MP, there are at least 80 MPs who would immediately back a challenger, then it's game over already anyway. And I do think this whole row demonstrates how genuinely serious the threats to Keir Starmer's leadership are being seen by those around Keir Starmer.
Henry Zuffman, our chief political correspondent, thank you. Well, let's speak to Kat Smith, who's the Labour MP for Lancaster and Wyre, former shadow cabinet minister under both Jeremy Corbyn and Sir Keir Starmer. Good morning.
Good morning.
Do you feel like Number 10 are planning a blocking manoeuvre here?
I don't know the decisions that's been made Number 10, but what I do know is that Labour Party members in Gorton and Denton are the people who should be deciding who the Labour candidate is for the by-election, and that the voters in Gorton and Denton are the people that will make the decision on who that person is when the by-election happens. And I think it would be disappointing if Number 10 were to block strong candidates from being able to be considered by the party members in Gorton and Denton to be able to choose their candidate in this by-election.
Are you happy with the way that Number 10 are approaching things at the moment? I was reading between the lines of what you're saying, and you said that it would be disappointing if there was a blocking move. Do you think they're handling this well?
Well, of course, we don't know what decision's been made, so it's hard to make a judgment on that. But what I do know, as a very long-standing Labour Party member, I've been a member of this party since I was a teenager, is that we're a democratic party. And my understanding is that when it comes to selecting parliamentary candidates and by-election candidates, it's my understanding that the rules of the Labour Party are that our members in said constituency are the decision makers on who that candidate should be. Now, I've served on the Labour front bench, as you've said, with both Keir Starmer and Andy Burnham in front bench roles, and I think they are both strong communicators. I think that they are both great Labour politicians.
So why in that case would Number 10 block Andy Burnham in this situation?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we don't know what decision has been made.
Well, you've said that a few times, but we need to work a little bit on hypotheticals here, because we're going to find out in the next 24 hours or so.
I mean, I believe that a strong Labour leadership would not be afraid of having another great Labour communicator in our Westminster team. In a hypothetical situation where Andy Burnham wants to be considered to be the candidate in this by-election, and we obviously don't know the answer to that, in that hypothetical situation where he wants to and the members want to select him as our candidate and the voters of Gorton and Denton, who are the real decision makers here, elect him, then that would be an asset to the Labour Party. I think Andy Burnham is an incredibly strong voice, particularly for the Manchester area and the north of England generally, actually, who would be an asset to our Labour team in Westminster in communicating the things that we're doing. And I suppose the frustrating thing this weekend is that we're talking about this and not about the things that Labour government is delivering. So whilst we're taking up their time,
we're not talking about it, and it's a Labour MP that's It's a Labour MP that's vacated the seat, so it sort of comes from Labour. When you have conversations with the Prime Minister, do you feel, does he inspire you with his leadership when you talk to him one-on-one?
If I'm honest, the only times I've spoken to him one-on-one are on the public record liaison committee and with one Prime Minister's question since the general election. I've not had the opportunity to talk to him one-on-one.
Not at all?
No.
That's interesting.
I think that there is a change in that, and I think that, that is disappointing. But the reality is that I think Number 10 have clocked that this is a problem now, and there are, I think, moves afoot for the Prime Minister to have more FaceTime with backbenchers like myself.
Do you think, given what you've just said then, do you think he is leading effectively? If you haven't had a conversation with him, do you think he's leading the party and the country effectively?
Absolutely. I do think that, you know, the things that he's been talking, you know, on the international stage and standing up for our troops who served in Afghanistan, I think that, yes, absolutely. I've never been prime minister, and it's really difficult for anyone who's not been prime minister, which includes both of us, of course, to know what is on their desk and all the things they have to do. It is always going to be a balancing act between representing our country on the national stage, managing your party, and delivering domestically. And I think sometimes maybe the balance hasn't been quite right, but my instinct is that is now changing, and I welcome that.
Kat Smith, thank you for joining us.
Tomorrow afternoon on Radio 4, let me take you there for a moment, a dark reworking of a Gothic tale.
BBC Radio 4's Story of America.
Where are you headed?
The village of Sleepy Hollow. Is this the right way?
A new adaptation of Washington Irving's legendary ghost story.
Did you see him when they started talking about the Headless Horseman?
After four nights, he did finally stand.
Under a full moon, not quite alive, not quite dead.
Literature that shaped America.
But if you spoke to 100 different people, they'd tell you 100 different things.
The Legend of Sleepy Hollow. Tomorrow afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Let's check the weather. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini. Morning.
Hello, good morning, Anna. Look towards the far southwest of the UK and the far northeast. Then there continue to be a lot of flood warnings in place. So take a look at the BBC Weather website for more details. Storm Ingrid still churning away in the southwest. It's bringing bands of showers across Wales and southwest England. Some really very heavy at times. The rainfall totals mounting up and some brisk winds towards the south coast as well, gusting as high as 50 to 60, even 60 plus miles an hour in exposure. And around about high tide in the next couple of hours, there could be some coastal overtopping. For the far northeast of Scotland, there'll be more rain driven onshore and a brisk easterly wind. There'll be some snow over the hills as well. For the far north of Wales, it is a little bit drier, but it's really quite wet across many parts of Wales. For Northern Ireland, early rain and showers clearing, drier later, some brighter breaks. For Western Scotland, largely dry with a bit of brightness. Eastern Scotland, that heavy rain. For the rest of England, it should be largely dry today with some brightness, a little windier, 5 to 9 degrees.
Elizabeth, thank you. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Anna Foster in Salford and Emma Bonnet in London.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock on Saturday, the 24th of January. The headlines today: the government has delayed a debate on ratifying its Chagos Islands deal, accusing Conservative peers who oppose it of reckless and irresponsible behaviour. Russia has launched another attack on Ukraine ahead of a second day of direct talks on President Trump's peace plan. And NHS England says a new database for genes linked to cancer will enable tens of thousands of patients to check whether they could be at risk of developing the disease.
Fascinating to hear about that earlier. But coming up in the next hour, politicians are wrestling with the idea of banning social media for under 16s here in the UK. But many teenagers have told us they will get around any such future ban. Does it matter if you introduce a law that lots of people won't obey? And
I've still got your letters. They have a lightness, a vivacity and a joie de vivre, with its complementary, a rather pensive melancholy, which recent history has just blotted out completely.
The love letters that changed history. Do you have any of those that sound like that in your trove? From the Tudors to Cold War spies, a new exhibition at the National Archives opens today and we'll be speaking to its curator.
I'm Sarah Orchard with your Saturday Sport. And after the England head coach, Steve Borthwick, named his England squad for the Six Nations yesterday, we speak with former England fullback Alex Good about the new faces and also the players that missed out.
But first, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The government has delayed a parliamentary debate on its controversial deal to hand back the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. The draft legislation was due to be discussed by the House of Lords on Monday, but the Conservatives have sought to stall it, saying it would breach a treaty with the US. Last week, President Trump criticised the deal. Our political correspondent Leila Nathu reports.
Under the terms of the government's proposed Chagos deal with Mauritius, the UK will lease back Diego Garcia, the largest of the islands, and home to a shared UK-US military base. The Conservatives claim passing the bill ratifying the deal would put the UK in contravention of a 1966 treaty agreed with the US over the islands. Last night, the Tories put down a motion to try to stall the bill's progress through Parliament until agreement is reached with the US over the treaty. Last month, the government said it was in talks with Washington over updating it. The White House initially backed the deal, but earlier this week, Donald Trump called it an act of great stupidity. Monday's debate in the Lords will not now go ahead. Government sources say they're considering their response and the legislation will return at a later date. A government spokesperson said it was fully committed to the Chagos deal and accused Conservative peers of reckless and irresponsible behaviour in interfering with national security priorities. The Tories said they would continue to fight the deal.
Russia has launched more missile attacks on Ukraine overnight after the first direct talks involving the two sides and the US on President Trump's plan to end the war. The Ukrainian authorities said the strikes killed one person and wounded at least 15 others in Kyiv and the northeastern city of Kharkiv. The peace talks in Abu Dhabi are due to continue today. Our correspondent Iruna Iyengar reports.
The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, said that the capital had suffered a massive enemy attack. According to Ukraine's air force, both drones and missiles were used in the assault and several buildings were hit, including a medical facility. People were urged to stay in shelters. In Ukraine's second city, Kharkiv, several apartment buildings were struck by drones. The strikes come after negotiators from Russia, Ukraine and the United States met yesterday in Abu Dhabi for the first direct talks on a plan being pushed by US President Donald Trump to end the almost four-year-long war.
The US has published its new national defence strategy, signalling more limited support for allies such as Europe and South Korea. The document says the top priority is now defending the US homeland and the Western Hemisphere. By comparison, the last strategy, published 4 years ago, focused on the threat posed by China. The NHS in England is launching a new database which patients can search to see if they're at risk of developing cancer. The register contains 120 genes known to increase the likelihood of getting the disease. Professor Peter Johnson is the National Clinical Director for Cancer at NHS England. He told us the database could be life-saving.
We can contact people to offer them screening and in some cases offer them preventative treatments. So people who have Lynch syndrome, which predisposes them to bowel cancer, for example, can take aspirin. We offer them colonoscopies. And next year, we're going to start a trial of a vaccine. So lots of opportunities, not only for more surveillance, but also for some early interventions for people who have these abnormalities.
The government says ministers will be given new powers to intervene in failing police forces in England and Wales as a part of a package of measures to be announced next week. The Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood promised action after the controversy over the decision by West Midlands Police to ban Maccabi Tel Aviv fans from a football match in Birmingham last year. The row led to the retirement of the force's chief constable. Current rules which prevent ministers from intervening directly will be changed, as our senior UK correspondent Seema Kotecha reports.
Police forces are currently not directly accountable to politicians. Ministers can't sack failing police leaders or instruct forces to improve. As part of the government's white paper on policing to be unveiled on Monday, ministers will be given new powers to send in specialist teams to turn around problematic forces. For example, if crime-solving rates or police response times are poor, experts from the best-performing forces will be sent to try to improve performance. There'll be new laws enabling the government to force the retirement, resignation or suspension of chief constables, and how a force is meeting new targets or neighbourhood policing levels, 999 response times and crime outcome rates will be published and used to grade them. The Home Secretary Shabana Mahmood says this will drive up standards, but some senior officers have told the BBC putting control into the hands of politicians undermines their leadership.
The proposals will also introduce a licence to practice for police officers in England and Wales, modelled on the system used for lawyers and doctors. Ministers say officers will have to renew their licences throughout their careers to demonstrate that they have the skills needed to fight crime. Those who fail to reach the required standard will be dismissed. The Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has until this evening to decide whether he wants to stand in the upcoming Gorton and Denton by-election. Winning there would allow Mr Burnham to return to Westminster as an MP and potentially mount a leadership challenge to Sir Keir Starmer. More from our political correspondent, Billy Kenber.
Andy Burnham has until 5 p.m. to ask Labour's ruling National Executive Committee for approval to put his name forward as a candidate for the by-election, permission he needs because he's a sitting mayor. Allies of the Prime Minister are expected to seek to block Mr Burnham from standing to avoid him mounting a leadership challenge if he won the by-election. Angela Rayner, the former Deputy Prime Minister, is understood to be among those who don't want to see Mr Burnham blocked. The by-election will take place as early as next month after ex-Labour Minister Andrew Gwynne formally resigned from the Commons on health grounds.
Surrey Police says two teenaged boys have been charged with murdering a 15-year-old who was fatally stabbed at a park in Guildford. The victim, Luis Gabriel Güemes, died at the scene on Monday. The suspects, who are 15 and 16, are due to appear before magistrates later today. An Australian boy who was bitten by a shark in Sydney Harbour last week has died in hospital. 12-year-old Nico Antic had been jumping off a rock with friends when he was attacked by what authorities suspect was a bull shark. It was one of four shark attacks on Australia's east coast in just 48 hours, as our correspondent Katie Watson reports from Sydney.
In a statement, Nico Antic's parents said they were heartbroken to share the news of their son's death. He was a happy, friendly and sporty young boy with the most kind and generous spirit, they said. Always full of life, and that's how they'll remember him. Nico Antic's friends were praised for their bravery after jumping into the water to pull him to safety when he was attacked last Sunday afternoon. But he suffered serious leg wounds and was taken to hospital in a critical condition. It was the first of four attacks along the east coast last week, three of them in Sydney. A rare spate of incidents that followed several days of heavy rain. And that, say experts, creates perfect conditions for bull sharks, who like murky water. After the attacks, many of Sydney's beaches were closed to protect the public until the weather improved.
The fourth series of the hit BBC show The Traitors has come to a dramatic end after 3 weeks of murders, betrayals and backstabbing. There was a final prize pot of almost £100,000. And if you haven't watched it yet, you might want to turn your radio down for the next 58 seconds during this report by our culture reporter Noor Nanji, which contains spoilers.
This series has been characterised by several twists on the original formula, which have increased the drama in the castle and seem to have gone down well with audiences. At the start of a nail-biting final, traitor Rachel survived banishment at the expense of faithful James. That left just five players in the game, from 22 at the start. But in the end, it was Rachel and fellow traitor Stephen who were crowned the winners. The first time two traitors have been victorious.
To the traitors.
To the traitors!
I've been dying to say that.
The winners share a prize pot of £95,750. This comes just a few months after a hugely successful celebrity spin-off featuring Alan Carr and Sir Stephen Fry. The show has become a cultural phenomenon, with millions of viewers tuning in every night. It has also succeeded in drawing in younger audiences and led to watch parties in homes and pubs across the UK.
That was our culture correspondent, Noor Nanji.
Alan, thanks very much. It's 10 minutes past eight. Ban under-16s from social media in this country. Love heart or scream emoji? What would you tap? Where do you stand? Australia took the plunge in December and now lawmakers here are looking at whether we should follow suit. All week on the programme, we've heard from parents, children, campaigners and politicians wrestling with the idea of a ban. Technology doesn't create societal ills, after all, but it does amplify and weaponise them, often leaving people of all ages alone with a screen, struggling to know how to respond, and the youngest of all social media users really struggling for context. And yet the youngest amongst us are also usually the most tech-savvy and can and will find their way around such bans. We're seeing that already in Australia with early reports. But does it matter if you introduce a law that many won't obey? Or does just having a law shift behaviour in the way that is seen to be desirable? Here's what one Australian teenager told us about getting around the ban when it started at the end of last year.
I've got backup accounts that are like above the age. Like I've got an Instagram account that I've been building up. I've got, it says it's a 21-year-old. I feed it sometimes. Like I look at like adult content, like stuff like old people like, I look like my dad's feed sometimes on that fake account because, like, he's kind of old.
Okay, spying on your dad there and other activities. Listening to that, Alex Chalk, KC, former Conservative Justice Secretary, now practising law again at Jones Day Law Firm. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Professor David Halpern, a British psychologist, public policy thinker and civil servant, probably best known for founding the UK government's behavioural insights team, widely referred to as the Nudge Unit. And the Nudge Unit, to remind you, applies behavioural science to public policy. So thinking about how to get people to do what you want, who better to have than David? Good morning.
Good morning.
Alex, could I start with you on the legal front, having been the Justice Secretary? I mean, I don't know where you stand on this. Perhaps also you could lay that out, what you think of the idea of a ban. But also that bigger question of, does it matter if you make a law that lots of people plan to break?
Yeah, well, I mean, I am broadly in favour. And I should say, I mentioned to my 13 and 11-year-old that I was going to say this. And they said, oh, no, don't say that, Dad. We'll be in terrible trouble with our peers at school. But anyway, so having got that out of the way. Look,
well, they can get it all out on social media before any such ban. Well,
exactly. They'll be fuming with me. Anyway, but the point is, look, as a general rule of thumb, it is dangerous for the rule of law, I have to accept, to create a law if you think it's going to be more honoured in the breach because it brings the whole thing into disrepute, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why I think if there were, heaven forbid, to be another pandemic, a lot of lawmakers would think twice about whether you should have such swinging laws in respect of what you can and can't do in terms of COVID restrictions because they were so breached. However, the reason why I think this is different is because some of the key law enforcers are not the police. It's in fact parents, and parents would be able to look to this in these difficult conversations with their children and say, look, this is the law. We are a family that obeys the law, and this is an important tool that parents could then use as part of their duty to try to bring up their children in a way that they think protects them. So I don't think you can look at all laws in the same light. General laws, whether it's speeding or COVID restrictions, that's one bucket. But when it comes to laws which are enforced by parents, I think different considerations apply. And that's why certainly amongst my peer group, there are so many of us who are saying, for goodness sake, we would love to have this so that it gives us another tool in the armory, so to speak, to try to protect our children, because we don't feel it's a fair fight at the moment with these very intoxicating and addictive algorithms.
Professor David Halpern, let me bring you in at this point. Away from the enforcement side of law, what does having a law do in terms of changing behaviour on a wider societal level?
Well, the key thing is what drives our behaviour is mainly social norms, what other people are doing. I mean, Alex's aside about, you know, what his kids' peers think, it's a really key clue, right? Is what do other people around us think is the right thing to do? We generally don't go into the office and defecate in the middle of the floor. We do say, hey, hello, good morning. We don't need a law to do that. So laws normally backstop, which is already an emerging social norm. And I definitely agree with Alex. What you definitely don't want to do is you don't want to create a law which there isn't support for, it gets broken down, and you're not even going to enforce it. Not only do you get breakdown on that specific area, you actually get spillover effects where people start breaking lots of other rules. So, you know, and so they can backstop it, and they can reinforce a social norm often. Oh, that's what we all agree. Oh, great. You know, and it can crystallize a new position.
When you say backstop it, what, you know, you mean that we have to already be in that place already? So are you saying we're heading that way, some of us already, and we need to give that more time to get there? Or how do you think the introduction of this should work in light of Australia, for instance?
Well, what you can sometimes get is what's called the dynamic social norm. So we respond to what we think other people are doing. It really influences our behaviour. We don't drop litter if we don't see other people dropping litter and so on. But it's also, where's the direction of travel we respond to? And sometimes the debate, as well as the law itself, we're kind of, where are you at? And you especially see this with new technology. There's a very famous old experiment in psychology where you go into a room and the smoke starts to come in and, you know, do you get up and say, oh my God, you know, there's a fire. And the more people are there, the less likely is anyone to get up. And the argument is that we look to other people in a strange new situation to say, well, what is the rule now? What should we do? And we're seeing that often with new technologies because we look to each other and we have to negotiate, well, how should we go on in, you know,
I'll bring Alex back in just a moment, but isn't there a slight problem there in this particular setting, or you tell me with what we can see from other examples, where there's a difference between perhaps how the older people of society, those with voting rights and those who make the laws, are potentially feeling about this in the direction of travel, and the younger?
Well, I can be empirically, as you'll know, we now see majorities in, you know, 30 countries just in a recent Ipsos Mori survey, and even in Britain we see in younger ages, remember we often don't have data on youngest people, but yeah, not on phones but on social media. So There is a pretty strong sweep there. And I'd just say, even in Australia, we...
David, in true amazing technological style, it cut out just as you said that and then came back to the word phone as you came back in to us. What did you say the data says?
Oh, sorry. Even amongst young adults, we now see a small majority in favour of a ban on social media. And I'll just say one piece. We did some work actually in Australia with young people, with teenagers a couple of years ago. And when you get them together and you say, what do you want? How do you want to play? Do you want to spend the first hour of every day doing your streaks? They say to each other, oh, God, no, I find it really oppressive. So you can sometimes crystallize this moment where you collectively say, oh, this is crap. Why don't we change the rule? What about, you know, how we behave about this technology?
Alex, on back to the legal side and where the government should come out on this, was it seen as too difficult? Were we not in this place before when you were the Justice Secretary? What do you think's changed?
Yeah, well, it's a great question. I mean, I think the views are evolving, but I think there was also an issue about whether we thought that the state could and should intervene in this way. And I think views have evolved. And funnily enough, when I was Defence Minister, one of my counterparts in South Australia was the now Premier of South Australia, Peter Malinauskas, who actually inspired this. And we had a chat on the way up to look at submarines in Barrow about this very issue, as you do. But look, I think the really big thing that Australia has done, which is super smart on the point that you first raised, is what they haven't done is said, right, we're going to create this law and now users, that's to say 15, 14-year-old children, are going to be at risk of criminal sanction. They haven't done that. What they've said is there will be no penalties for users, but penalties for the social media companies, because it would have been a major mistake to seek to penalise children, because then the whole thing would be more honoured in the breach, the law would be brought into disrepute, and you would risk criminalising young people. So I think when you're bringing it, when the state is acting, when it's stepping in, it's got to do so in a smart way, because otherwise you risk the law of unintended consequences and the spillover effect of people saying, look, we can be lawless in respect to the social media ban. Why don't we be lawless in a whole load of other things? So I think it's absolutely right to step in. It's absolutely right to give parents the protection and the tools that they need, but you've got to do so in a smart way. And I think that's broadly what the Australians have done.
David, are you worried, and if there is this concern, how best to think about this, around the darker side of the web then becoming more appealing? You talk about what people are doing around you. Obviously, the creation of VPNs and such like have become more prevalent depending on how the laws and the rules have changed just for adult users.
Well, it's got to be a concern. Generally, the empirical evidence on this is when you sort of squeeze down on a behavior like this, you only get a limited degree of displacement into other areas. But I would definitely look at supplementing it to shape the character of social media itself. So in the end, that's what our issue is. We've got to decide, is this smoking, which we just think we got to get rid of it, or is it food where if you use it well, it's okay? And there's a beautiful piece of work a few years ago in Britain, a survey of 15-year-olds about how different forms of social media affected them. And you could see that YouTube was terrible because it keeps scrolling at night, you know, but it didn't make you feel like rubbish if you were a 15-year-old girl, and Instagram did. So what you can do with this is you can actually introduce consumer power, and governments, I think, could do much, much more about making it clearer. So parents can have a discussion with their kids. Here's your smartphone, but yeah, let's not use Instagram, right? And then it makes it Instagram's problem profoundly. You start shaping the technology. So rather than worrying just about displacement onto the dark web, you change the existing platforms to be better, right? And so we can nudge the nudgers in that sense.
Nudge the nudges. Professor David Halpern, a good place to end. What a conversation which is only, it seems, in its infancy when it comes to what we're going to do in this country in terms of the law. Alex Chalk, KC, thank you to you as well.
It's 20 past eight. Well, it's nearly 21 minutes past, actually. Let's go from tech to books, the other end of the spectrum, because a big new neuroscientific study into what book clubs do for us is being launched. It's been commissioned by the Queen's Reading Room charity, which started back as an Instagram book club in lockdown. And it will look at the physiological and the psychological effects of not just reading, but shared reading in groups and how that's different for us. It's going to be led by Professor Sam Wass from the University of East London. Good morning.
Morning, Anna.
I'm curious about how you test for something like this.
Yeah, so there's lots of different ways that we test in terms of kind of brain activity and kind of bodily activity, which we'll get to in a second. But just to start with kind of the neuroscience of why there is a lot of evidence now that kind of reading is relaxing. So previous research by the Queen's Reading Room has shown that even short bursts of reading can reduce stress and improve concentration. And we're trying to kind of uncover some of the brain mechanisms for why that is. So basically, there are big differences between how our brains process information when we're reading compared with screens. So our brain's a prediction machine. So word by word, as I'm speaking, your brain is guessing what's going to come next. And when we're consuming information from screens, we have a lot of information coming at us very fast. So auditory and visual information. And it's often pitched by the designers at a level where it's a struggle for our brains to keep up. So this is exciting, but it puts our bodies into high alert mode. We're getting bombarded with a lot of information and we're trying to process it all really, really fast and on the fly. And when we consume information through reading, it's very, very different in a couple of ways. So firstly, the information that's actually coming at us is kind of low bandwidth. It's very, very simple. It's just black shapes on a white page. And what our brains do is we kind of self-generate information. So we build on top of that kind of very low bandwidth information that's coming in. So we imagine sights and sounds and smells based on the words that we read. But because from a brain perspective, this is information that the brain itself has generated, it doesn't kind of take us by surprise. It doesn't kind of challenge our brains in the same way. And the second key thing that's really key when you're in control of reading is that you're in control of the pacing. So if you think, you know, how your move as you're reading, so you'll read a couple of words and then you'll glance away and then you'll look back, and that's your brain, you know, controlling the pace that the information comes at you, and it only takes in new information when you're ready for it. So those are a couple of reasons why we think, you know, all of the evidence shows, and it's really good evidence, that reading does have this amazing effect of promoting calmness and relaxation.
Carriad Lloyd's with us as well, the co-host of the Weirdos Book Club podcast. Morning, Carriad.
Good morning.
What do you, and I'm really curious because I've never done book club stuff, although like you, I did do English literature, so I'm sort of a bit used to having conversations about it. But what's the difference when you're reading something collectively and when you're talking about it? How do you sort of describe the different things that it does to you, the different way it feels?
Well, yeah, I mean, so our podcast, we just choose a book each week and then we have a comedian or a writer come on and talk about it with myself and comedian Sarah Pascoe. And I think it's just a really joyful experience. You know, as we all know, if you've gone to see a film with a friend or, you know, watched, like you've just been talking about, The Traitors, it's kind of group experience. And being able to come back to people you love or people who are interesting and funny and say, what did you think of that bit? Why did they say that? Or I was so moved when that happened. And to have that group experience, I think as humans, it's just so important for us to be able to come back and connect with other people.
Yeah, sometimes you do just want to tell someone, oh, guess what happened? Or I really enjoyed that. Or how did that make you feel? And you know, it's great to have that feeling yourself, but to actually pick it apart with somebody else is quite joyful.
Yeah, and if you think this is, you know, as your amazing expert was saying, there's so many sources of information these days. And often we don't have those sort of, you know, moments where other people have read the same books as us or seen the same films, watched the same television. So it's quite rare these days. And I think that's why book clubs are so brilliant, why our podcast is so much fun to do, is they're like us and the listeners might be reading the same book, or they might not have read it, but they want to hear about it. And to have that group experience where you can come together and have those moments in books, which, you know, where you really think, my goodness, I've got to talk to someone about why that character did that or how she said no to that person. It's part of the enjoyment of reading, even though reading by yourself is also hugely enjoyable. I think making what seems like a solitary pursuit a group pursuit afterward is really satisfying.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, isn't it, Sam, that you know, as Carriad was saying there, we're talking about doing it with books, but actually you can do it with all sorts of things. Just that feeling of having somebody else to bounce off is a big part of it.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the angles that we're looking at in this research with the Queen's Reading Room and the Bentley Foundation is about the role of group, kind of books and book groups in helping people to recover from trauma. So the Queen's Reading Room does a lot of work kind of funding book groups with people like the Elm Foundation and St Mungo's. And, you know, this is area where, you know, what Carriad's been talking about is really, really important. And again, there's a really good evidence base that kind of book groups and shared reading is very effective for helping people to recover from trauma. And we're looking at why. And, you know, it comes back to this idea that I was talking about, you know, a lot of information coming at us. So often when we've had trauma, the after effects of trauma are very kind of high intensity and out of control. So kind of we get flashbacks, which tend to be very perceptually driven, and they're very visual and they're very auditory, and they're isolating. They take you away from other people into, you know, your own world. And when we're reading, you know, we get this incredibly close glance into, you know, the inner world of the character. But as I was saying, it's all this very low bandwidth. It's very controlled how we take this information in. You know, we're imagining. So it's self-generated brain activity, and stories are structured with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And the process of discussing in a book group is very controlled too. So there are a lot of reasons, I think, why, you know, for coping with this, you know, very out of control feeling of trauma, you know, book groups are a really, really kind of effective way to help people to cope.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us. It'll be fascinating to see what the results of that study are. Professor Sam Wass and Carrie Adloyd.
It's 27 minutes past eight. Sarah Orchard's back here now with the latest on the sport. Morning.
A very good morning to you. Well, it was a draw away for West Bromwich Albion last night in the Championship at Derby County, and that saw the visitors stop their 10-match losing streak. At the Australian Open tennis, the heat rule came into effect, meaning play on the outside courts was suspended as reigning champion Jannik Sinner progressed. There's more on that and a tense win for Prem champions Bath at Gloucester and Rugby Union, all on the BBC Sport website. But staying with Rugby Union, and England head coach Steve Borthwick named his squad yesterday for the fast approaching Six Nations. England will open their campaign at home to Wales on the 7th of February, and expectations will be high after England won 11 of their 12 test matches in 2025. Joining us this morning to pick through it all is former England fullback Alex Good. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. Now, before we pick through this squad, I just said there about the weight of expectation on England coming into this tournament after the results last year. Do you feel they're really ready to push for the title?
I do, yes. pardon me. I think this England squad have been building really, really nicely. I thought in the autumn they showed how to win sort of ugly at times, how to get through some sticky situations, but also how they're growing as a team in terms of attack. It seems to get better every week they play together. So hopefully they can keep some of that cohesion going into the Six Nations, and it's going to be a great tournament for them.
Now, there were three uncapped players in the squad, all forwards. Extra number eight, Greg Fisselau. Many people are expecting that name, but there's lots of injuries for England in the front row, so a chance to impress for a couple of props. There was the 20-year-old Bath player, Billy Seller, and then Northampton's Emmanuel Eigen. How do you rate both of them?
Well, certainly, I think they've come different paths. I think Eigen has been playing the Premiership for a number of years, has been incredibly consistent for Northampton, always seems to be available. They really rely on him a lot, solid in the set piece, and has got better and better in that aspect. But his game around the park is brilliant. He's fit, he's mobile, he makes good decisions, his ball handling's good, and obviously typical Northampton, he gets lots of touches on the ball, so he's very comfortable. So that's really interesting to see and deserved for the hard work he's put in. And then Billy Seller, someone who's just a real talent. We haven't seen loads of him in the Premiership, but he has been very explosive. He's learning a lot down there from Thomas Tatoy, Will Stewart at Bath, and his set piece work is very good for someone so young. But if I imagine he's there, not to make the numbers up, but to push the more experienced Davidson and Joe Hayes, but also to get a lot of experience and for Steve to see exactly what he's all about.
And Alex, I'll take you from the front row to perhaps an area you're more familiar with, which is the back three. There was no space in the squad for George Hendy and Alex Ollie Slightholm from Northampton, but also no space for the Saracens wing, Noah Kalori. Were you surprised at those three?
Well, without trying to sound too biased, I probably wasn't as surprised for Hendy and Slightholm. Slightholm hasn't played lots, and I think it was when I saw him the other week, I thought he's still getting his match fitness back. We know how good he can be, and he's a real athlete, but he needs to string a few games together. Hendy has been brilliant at fullback, but again, it's so tight for competition there. You know, Furbank comes back in, his club mate. You've already got Marcus Smith and Freddie Stewart there as fullback, so it's pretty tight. And wingers, you know, there's so many good wingers. And that's probably where it's been tough for Noah. Although I thought he'd get in because of his X factor in the air, I think he brings something that none of the other wingers do. Obviously, Freeman brings it, but more of a centre. perhaps it's just so much competition, you know. Arundel's back in form. You've got Freeman, as I said. Murley's been playing brilliantly, just to name a few. And then to come back from injury, you've got Roebuck as well. So,
Alex, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much for your time. So much talent in that squad. You can hear more from Steve Borthwick on the Rugby Union Weekly podcast.
Thank you, Sarah. It is just after 8:30 now at 9 o'clock. It's Saturday Live and Adrian Charles is here. Morning. What goodies have you got for us?
Good morning to you. We have for you Anton de Beck, fresh from the first night of the Strictly Tour. Also, our most successful Winter Olympian, Lizzie Yarnold, who's going to be telling us about the frankly balmy, terrifying, wonderful business of the skeleton bobsleigh. We've also got a gentleman called Michael O'Shaughnessy with us, who goes into prisons and sort of does therapy through smells and scents, gets inmates to pick up the scent of something and tell them how they feels. I don't know what you've got on this, Anna, Emma. I mean, for me, it's mothballs, actually, which I haven't smelt for ages. And I smelt one the other day. It reminded me of my nan's house in Zagreb. And it stopped me in my tracks completely. It's so powerful. I don't know what you've got. Anyway, 848.
It transports, doesn't it?
It does, yes. Have you got anything to declare on this?
I mean, there are sort of particular perfumes that take me straight back to sort of cheap and nasty nightclubs in South Shields in the mid-90s. But actually,
men's
on
or
this.
Women's? Brute? Yardley Gold?
Bit of everything, really.
Right, okay, yeah.
Bit of cheap body spray. Do you know what? I got some good advice on this. When I got married, which was quite a long time ago now, I bought a brand new perfume that I'd never worn before, wore it on my wedding day. And then after that, you only ever wear it when you're doing something really nice. So if you're going on holiday, if you're going out, something nice to eat. And then that particular smell, whenever you smell it, it will only ever remind you of nice, happy things.
Good tip.
You find as
like
you get older, it becomes increasingly rare. You only get to wear it once every few months.
I'll check that out with our expert. We've also, I should say, got Claire Foy's Inheritance Tracks and winner of the Anorak of the Year Award. Looking forward to speaking to him.
Oh, is that a real thing?
It is a real thing, awarded by the Global Dole Men's Club. And
excellent.
It's a UK triumph in that category.
It is. I look forward to that. Thank you, Adrian. Now, all that to come in Saturday Live on the way at 9 o'clock this morning.
The only way you can follow that is with the weather. Rain in the southeast and northeast Scotland and generally dry elsewhere. Windy.
You will need your anorak for that. It is 26 minutes to 9. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Emma Barnett in London and Anna Foster in Salford. Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The government has delayed a parliamentary debate on ratifying its deal to hand back the Chagos Islands to Mauritius. The legislation was due to be discussed by the House of Lords on Monday, but the Conservatives moved to stall it, saying it would breach a treaty with the US. One person has been killed and at least 15 others have been injured in Russian air raids on Ukraine overnight. The first direct peace talks between Kyiv, Moscow and Washington are due to resume today. NHS England is launching a new genetic database to help patients assess their risk of cancer. It says it's building the first register of its kind of 120 genes known to increase the likelihood of getting the disease. And the government says ministers will be given new powers to intervene in failing police forces in England and Wales as part of measures to be unveiled next week. Under the plans, all forces will be made to answer to the Home Secretary.
Thank you, Alan. 25 to 9 now. Insulting and frankly appalling. That was the Prime Minister's verdict on Donald Trump's comments about NATO forces staying back from the front lines during the war in Afghanistan. Prince Harry also joined the backlash. He said that the sacrifices of NATO troops deserve to be spoken about truthfully and with respect. The White House did answer questions. It issued a short statement talking about the US's contribution to the alliance. But what it didn't acknowledge is that what Donald Trump had said was factually wrong. Well, back in July of 2009, the war in Afghanistan was at one of its most dangerous moments. 8 British soldiers were killed in just 2 days. And Sarah Montague was there at that time for Today. She attended their repatriation ceremony.
At 1:30 this morning, Camp Bastion, as usual, was wide awake with helicopters and planes taking off and landing. This is when it's safest for them to fly. Even at this hour, the heat is unbelievable. And as in the day, the dust is everywhere. In the midst of the usual comings and goings at the airstrip stood a vast C-17 transporter plane. its rear ramp down, the light from its interior illuminating the runway, and the two lines of men, in single file, forming a corridor away from the rear of the plane. 200 men, silently waiting to say goodbye to their friends. For the next hour, with the sound of the plane's engines as a backdrop, an intensely moving, silent vigil took place. One by one, the coffins of the eight men, each borne by their fellow soldiers and covered with a Union flag, were carried very slowly down the corridor of men and onto the plane. Three of those killed were just 18. Many of their comrades had arrived from the front line just a few hours before. Unable to come home for the funeral, this was their chance to say goodbye to their friends. And their grief was palpable. With the coffins and their bearers on the plane, the bugle major sounded the last post, struggling to be heard over the noise of a helicopter nearby. Then the chaplain and bearers marched off the plane. The rear ramp clanged shut. The floodlights went off. And for a few moments, everything was dark. The plane, now a casket, and the line of soldiers silhouetted against the Afghan night sky.
That was Sarah Montague speaking very powerfully back in 2009 in Afghanistan. Well, General Sonic Carter joins us, former chief of the defence staff and a veteran also of that war, served numerous tours of duty. General, good morning. Thank you for joining us.
No, thank you and good morning.
What Donald Trump said has really drawn a backlash. And I think the discussion needs to not be about whether he was right or wrong, because factually he was wrong. And what I'd like to talk about is what that does to our military relationships in the future. But I would like to give you the chance to speak to what you heard from him and really what your experiences in those days were.
Yes, I mean, of course, you know, my reaction to what he said is one of disgust and disappointment. But sadly, I wasn't particularly surprised, because it's the sort of thing he's said before. And he's notable, I think, in being exceptionally unqualified to comment on war. I mean, given that he dodged the draft five times. And it's not just British and European troops that he has contempt for. He has no respect for US veterans either. I mean, you'll remember back in the day, he said of John McCain that he's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people that weren't captured. And then incredibly, when he went to visit the American cemeteries in Normandy for the 75th commemoration in 2019, and I was there as well, he observed that the American soldiers who were buried there were losers. You know, he described those people who'd served his country and had died in the service of his country as losers. So this is obviously a man who has absolutely no respect for service or for duty. And of course, also, I think, no understanding or interest in understanding war, let alone what a front line might be on a battlefield. So to my mind, he's extremely unqualified to comment on this. And therefore, you know, one can only be amazed that he should enter into this debate in the way he has.
Do you think that the comments like that, given the position that he holds, have an impact on the future health of the military alliance between the UK and the US, NATO, others?
I mean, I think that at the political level, it's obvious that they will have an impact. But I'd like to hope that at the institutional level, where we have extraordinarily close relationships with both the US military and, of course, their intelligence services, that we will be able to manage this and hope that in 2028 or whenever Donald Trump steps to one side, that the relationship will be able to continue as we knew it. That said, I do think the world has changed, and I think we need to wake up and realise that we are at the end of an era of history. We now have this 19th century president, and we've got to realise we're in the 21st century. And that requires us, I think, to be much more thoughtful about how we act as a country and act in alliance with our friends in Europe and elsewhere.
It's interesting that you say that, and no accident, I'm sure. I mean, we saw just in the last few hours that the Pentagon has published its new national defence strategy, which it publishes once every 4 years. And it says that China is no longer the top security priority for the US. It talks instead about the security of the US homeland, the Western Hemisphere. As you said, the world is changing and we're seeing it happening in real time in front of us.
Yes, and I think, you know, the United States will wake up and realise that it can't just secure the Western Hemisphere. It needs to be a global power, not least because the sort of minerals and rare earths that it requires to sustain its future are not going to be found solely in the United States. You know, they're going to need to have relationships in Africa and elsewhere in the world. So they can't just simply revert to being a Western Hemisphere-only nation. It doesn't work like that. And they will leave the world open to others, which I don't think is necessarily what we all want to see.
I mean, it also talks about more limited support being offered by the Pentagon to US allies, but also their view of Europe. And again, we've seen it playing out in front of us in the last sort of couple of weeks when we've talked about Greenland and Donald Trump's aspirations when it comes to annexing Greenland. But again, that sort of relationship, fundamental relationship between Europe and the US is changing too, isn't it?
No, it absolutely is. And I mean, you know, I do think, you know, we've all talked about Mark Carney's speech last week at Davos. You know, the reality is that we are in a new world, and our European leadership has got to wake up and recognise that we need to wake Europe as a sleeping giant. And the plain fact is that when we look at our economies, they're not that dissimilar to the United States. And if we speak more with one voice and we re-equip ourselves to be able to add the hard power that needs to be recognised as the key ingredient these days, then we can make it work. The challenge, of course, is time is short, and we can't afford to vacillate up until 2035. You know, the moment has come when we need to be ready, and I'm afraid we're slightly behind the par curve.
General Sir Nick Carter, thank you very much for joining us.
It's 18 minutes to nine, as it's Saturday. We can take a moment to reflect on the week that was and some of the issues that defined the agenda. And to help us to do that, our panel, which this week is made up of Philip Collins, editor of Prospect magazine. Congrats on that.
Quite Thank
new,
you very much.
New in the poster, newly in there. And Isabel Hardman, assistant editor of The Spectator. Good morning, Isabel.
Morning.
Thank you for being with us as well. And we'll know by 5 o'clock this afternoon, I believe, that's what we've been saying, certainly, around whether Andy Burnham, Mayor of Greater Manchester, will throw his hat in the ring or be given permission to throw his hat in the ring by the Labour executive, as it were, to stand for being an MP once more. And Isabel, you may be thinking, or listeners may be thinking, why do I need to pause for thought on this? But should they?
Well, of course. I mean, this is Andy Burnham's third shot at the Labour leadership, so we should all be very excited by this. And I think, look, I think it's really interesting in terms of the sort of the machinery of this and how Keir Starmer's allies seek to deal with this. Do they try to block him? It does seem that way at the moment. I wouldn't say that that's necessarily a sensible long-term strategy. I think some of the sort of more brutish blockings that we saw at the last election didn't actually work in Keir Starmer's favour politically in the long term. I would also say that I don't think Andy Burnham is the smoothest of operators himself. He's a bit like me when confronted with a revolving door in terms of making things go spectacularly wrong. So there's that. But I also think that in terms of what it says about the Labour Party, it's much more interesting because I think that Keir Starmer at the moment is the leader the Labour Party deserves, in the sense that Labour still doesn't really know what it stands for in the modern day. It wants to appeal to voters who, as we're very aware, are already very angry and deserting it. It knows that there are things that actually those voters are angry about that run against Labour's instincts. And so it's ended up with a leader in Keir Starmer who doesn't really know what he believes other than in sort of, you know, doing things properly. And I'm not sure Andy Burnham is a huge transition from that. He's much more passionate than Keir Starmer. He at least gives the impression of believing something, even though a lot of his colleagues will say that he'll go into another room and believe the opposite. But actually, in terms of what he would do with the Labour Party and in terms of what he actually thinks, what his core political sort of driving forces are, I think they're probably as confused as Starmer. They're just dressed up better.
I mean, let me bring you in here, Philip, to respond to some of that, because, you know, you could be forgiven. I like the way that Isabel went straight from when I asked, is he going to stand as an MP, to this is his third shot at the Labour leadership, just in case anyone was wondering how you get from that to that. But that is the leap that is imagined to be happening here, should he be given the green light. But you could be forgiven for sounding like you're waking up to the political version of Traitors if you'd enjoyed the finale last night.
night. I have to bring that up beyond the bulletin so we can just reflect. We know that that happened last night and some of you are still reeling from it, especially if you went to a pub gathering on it. But Philip, how do you think the Labour Party and traitors are comparing, and what do you read on this?
Well, I think there's a big question for the faithful in the Labour Party, which is, do they try to prevent Andy Burnham? That's the first question. I think it would probably be foolish to try to stop him, even though I think they'll probably try, because it may well be that the attempt to stop him crystallises the discontent around Keir Starmer, which is real and which has been well noted. So I think they're probably better off to try and allow him to stand and then manage the situation. And the whoever becomes the leader of the Labour Party, whether Keir Starmer remains or whether it passes to someone else, they won't change instantly the background conditions, which are the main cause of the weakness of the Labour Party, which is to say that if you're trying to be Prime Minister when we've got no growth, it is going to be difficult. And we always ascribe the weakness of a politician to them, to their character. Mm. Actually, imagine a very strong person perched on the edge of a cliff. They're in a weak position. Now, you can criticise Keir Starmer's stewardship of the nation, but he is nevertheless in a series of weak positions. And that won't change immediately just because they change the leadership. The Tories have given us an absolutely perfect drama in how changing your leader does not necessarily lead to salvation. The Labour Party might be about to enter a similar drama.
Talking of drama and where a lot of it plays out, social media, we had a very interesting discussion at 8:10 about how you change behaviour. This is the idea now that politicians, certainly the lawmakers, are starting to really consider an under-16s ban on social media use. Where are you on this, Philip, in terms of, you know, not just the political side, but, you know, whether the state should make this move?
I don't have a problem in principle with the state making a move with things with respect to children, people below the age of majority. I've always thought I don't mind a nanny state as long as it's acting as a nanny. So I don't know whether the practicalities stack up of a ban, but I don't have a principled objection to it. And I think there is undoubtedly a problem. And so if, for once, the government were to take a problem and make a radical move in it, I think I'd rather be behind it.
Isabel?
Yeah, I mean, I'm often troubled by the instinct in politics to address the something must be done problem. So, undoubtedly, we've ended up with a Wild West where we're sort of, in social media terms, leaving our front doors open for our teenagers and not keeping them safe or helping them grow up healthily to be able to deal with social media. I think a lot of us as adults aren't very good at that either. But I am quite troubled that the debate seems to be moving in the way that lots of debates on hot button issues, I'm thinking particularly gender, have moved, where you have proponents of a certain thing who are saying, this is the thing, you know, something must be done. We've found the solution. If you don't want to ban social media, then you don't care about child safety. And there's starting to be a crowding out of nuance or a desire for proper discussion. I really noticed that around the debate in the Lords this week, a desire for discussion about how much evidence do we have that this kind of ban not just would work, but would actually be appropriate in the way that we bring children up. You know, I think I heard one peer saying we don't need any more evidence. And I was thinking, well, I mean, I've never heard a scientist say, oh, we don't need more evidence. And I'm always really troubled when politicians become so zealous about the policy that they themselves have come up with that they refuse to see what could turn out to be really serious flaws with it when it's implemented.
Well, also, we were discussing, Philip, just finally quickly, if you can, you know, what it does when you have a law that is there behaviourally, what it does to people, even if it's not fully followed, you know, just sort of taking in the influence of what changes behaviour.
Yes, I mean, law is only one thing that changes behaviour. Obviously, sometimes the law lags the change of behaviour. So the big changes into liberalisations of the 1960s actually were confirmations of places the public had largely got to already. I do think that something must be done. That claim doesn't have to mean that it leads directly to a ban. But I think to suggest that there's no problem with this massive experiment we're conducting on children is probably unwise.
And we're conducting ourselves at the same time. Philip Collins, editor of Prospect magazine, Isabel Hardman, assistant editor of The Spectator. Good faithfuls there on the movings and shakings of the Labour Party, which will rumble out, we think, at around 5 o'clock, certainly in terms of Andy Burnham, and also on social media. Thank you.
It's 10 to 9 now. Here on the programme, we've been, well, making the most, actually, over the last few weeks of marking the National Year of Reading, which is all about getting more people of all ages reading for pleasure. And some of our most cherished writers have been joining us, reading from the book that ignited or reignited their love of reading. This morning, it is Professor Sir Jonathan Bate, biographer, literary critic, professor of English literature, and he has chosen the complete short stories of Sherlock Holmes and reads here from The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle, first published in Strand magazine all the way back in 1892.
I always loved reading and being read to as a young child. But then I got to that age of about 12 or 13 when, like so many other boys, football and pop music became more of an excitement, a passion. But my love of reading was reignited when, I think it was on my 12th or 13th birthday, my parents gave me the complete short stories of Sherlock Holmes. And perhaps because the stories were short, they had a beginning, a middle and an end, I was eager to know the nature of the crime and dazzled by the quality of Conan Doyle's writing and the brilliance of Sherlock Holmes' mind, my passion for reading was reignited and sustained all through those crucial teenage years. Here's a short passage from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's short story about Sherlock Holmes, The Adventure of the Blue Carbuncle. And in this passage, Sherlock Holmes is examining a battered old hat, and Dr. Watson asks what it can tell him. "Then pray tell me what it is that you can infer from this hat." He picked it up and gazed at it in the peculiar introspective fashion which was characteristic of him. "It is perhaps less suggestive than it might have been," he remarked, "and yet there are a few inferences which are very distinct and a few others which represent at least a strong balance of probability. That the man was highly intellectual is, of course, obvious upon the face of it, and also that he was fairly well-to-do within the last 3 years, although he has now fallen upon evil days. He had foresight, but has less now than formerly, pointing to a moral retrogression, which, when taken with the decline of his fortunes, seems to indicate some evil influence, probably drink, at work upon him. This may account also for the obvious fact that his wife has ceased to love him. My dear Holmes, he has, however, retained some degree of self-respect," he continued, disregarding my remonstrance. "He is a man who leads a sedentary life, goes out little, is out of training entirely, is middle-aged, has grizzled hair which he has had cut within the last few days, and which he anoints with lime cream. These are the more patent facts which are to be deduced from his hat. Also, by the way, that it is extremely improbable that he has gas laid on in his house." The thing that struck me when I first read that passage, and I can remember reading it at the age of 12 or 13, and that I still find today, is the way in which the precision of the detail in the writing matches the precision, the detail in the mind of the character. And that immediately brings the character alive. And of course, it makes you want to turn the page and find out how on earth did Sherlock Holmes work out so much from a hat? And then what is the adventure, the crime that is going to follow from his discovery of the hat?
That is Professor Sir Jonathan Bate on the wonderful works of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. More of those still to come. It is 6 minutes to 9 now.
500 years of devotion, longing and passion. That's how a new exhibition of 5 centuries of love letters at the National Archives at Kew is being described. Among the exhibits is a never-before-seen love letter from the Cambridge Spy Ring's fifth man, John Cairncross, to his ex-girlfriend Gloria Barraclough. They met in their early 20s. This letter was written after they'd been separated by the Second World War. The linguist was already passing secrets to the Soviets by then. We asked the actor Sam West to read an extract.
"Dearest Gloria, I was more than delighted to receive your exquisite telegram. And if I haven't replied earlier, it's partly because I felt that it would be easier for you to decipher my abominable writing in sunny spring weather, and partly because I thought I'd better wait till I got the long letter you promised me. I'm sure that you're still writing it and that it is now very long indeed, so that I look forward all the more to receiving it. In the meantime, this is just to tell you that I'm still in existence and that partly because it's spring, partly because the world situation is so much more favourable, but most of all because writing to you seems to have some magical effect on me. I feel much less subhuman than I've done since 1937. Seems a long way off, doesn't it? Heaven, by comparison with the events of the past 7 years. And alas, a heaven that we, like most people, didn't fully appreciate at the time. Would we have broken off, I wondered, if we had known what was coming? It was a very great loss to me. Even though I still kept in touch with your sunny personality through the medium of correspondence, such charming correspondence, I've still got your letters. They have a lightness, a vivacity, and a joie de vivre, with its complementary, a rather pensive melancholy, which recent history has just blotted out completely. Do write soon. All my love. John.
How does that measure up to your own love letter trove? I'm sure you'll be thinking of some notes you may have sent now or received. Vicky Iglowski, Broad, curator of the Love Letters exhibition at the National Archives in Kew, which opens today, I should say, has just joined me. How do you have these love letters?
That's a great question, actually. So essentially, in the records of government that we hold, we have these little incidences that spread through the collection of expressions of love that we just wouldn't expect in a state archive. This particular example is actually a loan. It's the one loan in the exhibition. But we have many other items relating to monarchs, paupers, a whole variety of people that have, in their interactions with government, found their way into the collection and have these kind of extraordinary expressions of love.
It's quite mortifying that your love letters end up in the government in some way, or the state archive.
They certainly can, yeah. Some are in the context of kind of criminal cases. Others are through people's kind of writing into government. There's all sorts of reasons that these come up.
And how many will be on show?
So we've got 28 items on show. So in a way, it's just the kind of tip of the iceberg of the potential of what we have in our records.
All love letters. That's the
They're love letters, but we've got kind of a kind of open definition of what we're considering a love letter. So some are very traditional items, kind of handwritten, sent in the post. But others, we're kind of thinking about where these expressions exist in the archive. So we've got items like wills that we're reading as expressions of love, particularly lesbian love, for example, in the past, which was harder to write down and preserve.
How you left things would perhaps, you know, show where, who you cared about.
Absolutely. So we've got Jane Austen's will, a really iconic record that shows her sisterly bond and love with Cassandra that they had throughout their life. And like you say, what tells us more than who you look after once you're gone?
Have you got a personal favourite from the 28? Or was that too hard to...
It's a hard question, but we have a beautiful love letter between two men from the 1930s. Again, love that's often not preserved. It's hugely risky to write down. And we've got this letter between Cyril and Maurice talking about the kind of emotions they're feeling. Cyril is disappointed his love is not coming to the club that night. And it survives because it's in the context of police records, a raid on the Caravan Club, which was a kind of venue at the time that was provided relative safety for those kind of men. So we have these expressions that you wouldn't expect that are deeply heartfelt and really poignant.
Yes, and I suppose, as you say, in difficult contexts, some of them as well, but interesting now to present them in that. And I'm just thinking if people even do send love letters anymore, it might prompt a few revivals.
It's a great question. We've actually learned that there is a bit of a boom at the moment. People are going back more to the kind of paper, the mindfulness of writing physical things. So it feels like a great time to have this free exhibition on at the National Archives.
It's free. It opens today. Go and see 500 years of love letters. Vicky, thank you very much for taking us through it.